Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
Education beyond high school, the cost can put it out of reach, but we can help. Go to federalstudentaid.ed.gov. The most costly education is the one not begun. Federal Student Aid. Start here. Go further.
Phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and welcome, everybody. A pleasure to be with you for another Sunday night emanating from here in Detroit, WRIF, broadcasting all across the country, all across the world, via the Internet. You can call us up because we are a phone-in talk show, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Night Call brought to you this hour by Waking Up, Metro Detroit Sweatshop Free Clothing Store. It's kind of a tongue twister. Sweatshop Free Clothing Store, there you go. Located in the Universal Mall at 12 Mile Road in DeQuinder in Warren. You can go to their website, wakingupstore.com. This is still Black History Month, so actually now they... Well, let me introduce. Jolene Jordan, hi.
Peter, hi.
Hi. I was just starting... It is actually now African American History Month. It began, by the way, probably sometime in the... Like over 100 years ago as Negro History Week, when people of African origin were in, as you know, and most people know, terrible situation, not only in the South, but in the North as well. And if I had my memory together, I'd remember the man that actually began it. But it was incredible to say that these were a people with a history. So this is a very important month.
Oh, yes.
But actually, at some point, we're going to, I don't know, maybe people don't agree with this. We'll take the African off of that, and the history of people of African origin will be properly integrated just into American history.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah,
right.
And how long do you think it's going to be before?
About 5,000 years.
Right.
To get rid of all these racists.
Right.
That's cynical, isn't it?
Well, I think that racism still has a very long way to go. It may not in this room.
What? Oh, not in this room.
Right.
Okay, I thought you were calling me out or something.
No. It doesn't have a long way to go in this room.
Oh, I got you. Did I introduce you by name and everything?
I believe you did.
Okay.
Yeah.
My mind is all over the place.
Well, then I think that it's par for the course.
Yes,
you're right. It's the show as usual. Let's go.
Jalene Jordan is with me. I'm Peter Werby. And Jalene is our producer and also our on-air co-host.
And you have me working hard, Peter. You worked me hard this week.
Setting up these guests.
Yeah.
A lot of interesting people.
Yeah.
Yeah, including, who do we have?
Oh, this week, you know what? I really, you pick those. I may set them up for you.
Those are mine.
But yeah. You do.
Actually, we're going to, this guy is very interesting. Ali Abu Nima.
Okay.
And he's written a book called One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Impasse. Most people talk about a two-state solution. There'll be Palestine here and Israel here.
Yeah.
An Arab-Muslim state and a Jewish Israel state. And Ali Abu Nima says one state. So we'll get the
one state with everyone.
Yeah, with everyone. Yeah.
Then, really?
William Rivers Pitt, author of House of Ill Repute, Reflections on War, Lies, and America's Ravaged Reputation.
He is an interesting man. Yeah. You've interviewed him many times, but always good.
He is one of the founders of truthout.org. Truthout.org. So that's always a good website to go to check.
Full of good progressive info.
By the way, the reason I started talking about African American History Month is that when you go to the Waking Up store and you purchase more than $50, you get a free soft cover copy of Down Through the Years, written by former Detroit City Council President Irma Henderson and Mike Kitchen, who is the co-owner of the Waking Up store.
I tell you, that store is so ahead of its time.
Yes, it is. CallTalkYes@Yahoo.com. CallTalkYes@Yahoo.com. My personal site is Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E, PeterWerby.com. Jalene Jordan's is J-U-L-I-N-E, Jordan.com.
And you know what? The one that I use most of all is this MySpace. You know, I should set one up for you, Peter. Bring you. I'll manage it for you.
Okay.
I really love this stuff.
Okay.
I resisted it for a very long time, just like Arthur Penhallow did. Did I say it right? You have a real thing with that name.
Yeah.
And,
By the way, Arthur Penhallow does afternoons here on WRF.
If you didn't know that already.
I mean, there's people listening on Saipan, the South Pole.
Okay,
Finland,
so for you
Korea,
who don't know, 37 years he's been on this station anyhow.
Yeah.
So this MySpace, I want to direct everyone there because you've played a song that I recorded called Baghdad and Beyond many times on this show. And I finally got it up on my MySpace in its entirety. You can download it and everything for free. And it's MySpace.com/ Jalene Jordan Music.
Okay.
So go to that one.
That's
and
cool.
Check out
That's
Baghdad
cool.
and Beyond.
Yeah,
thank you.
Great music, too. By the way, since we're all, that'd be you and me tooting our own horn. Here's my toot for me.
Okay.
I'm going to be speaking a couple places around the country on March 2nd. There's something called the Rouge, like the Rouge River, the Rouge Forum, R-O-U-G-E. You can go to rougeforum.org, and they're having a conference, a national conference on how to be anti-war and pro-learning. They're a group of teachers and educators, and the name of their conference is Their Wars Left Behind, Education for Action. And I'll be speaking there 10:45 a.m. on Saturday. You can see the schedule by going to the...
Where is this, Peter?
Oh, Wayne State University. Thank you.
Okay.
Wayne State University in Detroit. No, that's good you're doing
and
that.
And give their website. Sorry.
Rougeforum.org.
Great.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you. And then at the Left Forum, what's all this forum stuff?
Well, I don't know.
March 9th through the 11th in New York City. the Left Forum is having this huge deal where they have all this, political, social stuff, talk.
Nice.
Yeah. And I'm going to be hosting a panel on political satire, the politics of ridicule.
Really? Have you thought about what you're... What's your main focus?
I'm the moderator of the panel.
You are? Okay. Yeah. So will they be bringing some satirists?
Yeah.
Barry Crimmins going to be there?
No, I hadn't thought about that. No, I don't. I can't remember who's going to be on the panel. But if you go to leftforum.org and then slog through it, you'll eventually find it. It's not an easy site to navigate. But I'm going to be speaking at noon on Saturday. It's at Cooper Union, which is in the village, the East Village. And it's a famous old place. So Abraham Lincoln spoke there.
Jeez, Peter. This is cool.
Yeah, it is very cool.
Wish I could go to hear you.
Yeah, and I'm flying out there in one of those 50-seaters.
You are?
Yeah.
You're not a fan of those.
No, actually I am. I like
Take
those.
Your People magazine. That's what I do. It'll calm you down instantly.
No, I'm a new guy. I've transferred all that anxiety I had about flying. Actually, it doesn't make me anxious at all. What makes me anxious now is driving.
Oh, so you've transferred your anxiety? Is this what you're telling me?
Maybe, but at least it's sensible. I mean, so many people I know, I know people that have been killed in the last 3 or 4 years in automobile accidents, severely injured, terrible head injuries, and I don't know anybody that's been hurt in a plane accident.
Yeah.
All right, what are we doing here? 313-298-WRIF. As usual, I don't know where to start.
It was quite a week.
It was.
And and we're not talking about Britney Spears shaving her head.
No. God.
Which is the hottest news story. It's so sad.
Think about how many guys were just, what guys think about. And then, oh, man, if I could only hook up with someone like her. careful what you wish for, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Although I had someone tell me they think she looks hotter than ever that way.
Well, what was that woman, like, from the 80s? Right, that insulted the Sinead, she had an Irish name.
Sinead O'Connor.
Sinead O'Connor.
Where she tore up
the photograph of the Pope.
Of the Pope on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, I think didn't that end her career?
Well, that was really, she only had one big hit song.
Yeah.
She has a cult following, and I think they still follow her. She's gone in and out of all kinds of stuff, but she still, I believe, performs and tours
That's
once
good.
In a while.
Well, things are still going to hell in Baghdad. 63 die as blast disrupt Iraq clampdown. Yeah, disrupt, hello. Car bombings killed at least 63 people, left scores injured, and sent a grim message to the officials, boasting that extremist factions were on the run, which ain't the case. And in fact, good guerrillas, and with quote marks around good, no, you don't stand and confront the enemy. So if the enemy, which is an occupier or whoever, whether it's Light Horse Harry Lee fighting my relative, fighting the British in South Carolina in 1777. When the Brits come, you don't confront them directly. So I'm sure whoever, and increasingly you find out from U.S. soldiers, they're saying, we don't know who we're fighting. And whoever they're fighting, the guerrillas, the irregulars, the insurgents, confront overwhelming military force directly. So they're just probably going somewhere else for a while or just, kind of taking it easy. Meantime, Bush beating the war drums about Iran. And there's still this great dispute about whether or not Bush is going to order an attack on Iran. The military doesn't seem up for it at all. The fact that Marine General Peter Pace contradicted Bush when Bush said that these specific kind of roadside bombs were the result of this of the Iranian government, and he says, well, it's not real clear. What he's signaling is the military does not want to do that. So I don't know whether, I think I might have said last week, I have a bet that the United States is not going to attack Iran.
No, you didn't talk about the bet. You haven't talked about the bet, but you do have one.
Well, my friend.
Not with me.
Well, $50 we've bet. Either side goes to Food Not Bombs.
Fabulous.
Yeah, foodnotbombs.org if you want to check those people out.
You know, something. I was watching a lot of the morning political shows this morning.
Yeah.
Some weeks I watch them, some I don't. But I really wanted to watch this morning because Katrina VandenHeuvel from The Nation magazine, and that is The Nation. Is it TheNation.org or TheNation.com?
I think it's .com. Okay. TheNation.com.
Yeah, excellent magazine. And I was happy that she was in the MSM, mainstream media,
yeah,
to use your words. Basically, what I learned this morning is that, you know, maybe I should have known this already. The Sunnis are getting their arms from Saudi Arabia. The Shiites are getting it from Iran. So what are we supposed to do? Why are we talking? Why are we never talking about Saudi Arabia?
Why? What is that called? Oh, yeah. It's called a civil war.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And the Shiite-dominated central government of Iraq is extraordinarily close to Iran. I mean, half, yes, of these ministers, they travel between the ministers of the government whose salaries we're all paying with our tax dollars. They're like, you know, tight with Iran.
Very much. You know, they closed down one of the main roads to Iran on their big clampdown that resulted in 56 dead and 127 injured. U.S. servicemen dead. But now that's back open again. How long was that? About a week?
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, our friend at the, I think this is it, Global Network. What is that? Well, anyway. Okay. Bruce Gagnon, remember?
Oh, sure.
SpaceForPeace.org.
Right.
Yeah, Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. But they're talking about an assault that has been planned on Iran since November 2003. Now, as I've said before, there's plans in the Pentagon for attack and occupying every single country in the world. And so it's not odd that the U.S. Strategic Command near Omaha completed preparations. They got something called CONPLAN 8022, Contingency Plan 8022, and they're ready to go. And what they ask, can you imagine the public reaction, particularly in the Muslim world, if the war plans taking shape at STRATCOM were common knowledge? They say, here we have the command center for the world's largest nuclear arsenal orchestrating an unprovoked attack, possibly even with nuclear weapons, on a non-nuclear Muslim nation in order to prevent that country from even developing nuclear power for civilian purposes for fear it might someday make a bomb as well. We don't know what their intentions are. They say that it's only for nuclear energy. But it's totally nutso. Like, let me see. This little thing. You know, these things, Jalene, just kind of appear unconnected and unanalyzed in the MSM. The mainstream
media.
General John Craddock of the United States Army, who recently took over as NATO Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, said Russia had nothing to fear from a planned anti-missile system the United States wants to install in Poland and the Czech Republic. Now, this completely violates the 1980. Where is this? These missile shields are impermissible.
It blows my mind that I have to quit saying that the government that's in power right now just continues to ignore every single one of these regulations.
The Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty of 1987, in which the United States and the Soviet Union agreed to eliminate land-based ballistic and cruise nuclear missiles with a range of up to 3,400 miles. So here, again, the United States is fighting a war on the periphery of Russia, this heavily nuclear-armed power. Now they're saying they're going to install these anti-missile shields. Now, who is this aimed against? They say, now here's what the general said. It's been clearly stated that the U.S. intention is to provide defense against missiles from a rogue nation. Although he did not name any country, the anti-missile site would be designed to stop attacks by Iran against the United States and its European allies. I mean, this, dear friends, radio friends, is pure madness. The idea that Iran in the Middle East would attack Poland or the United States is just absurd. And what this does is create a new arms race, and that's what Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, he reacted angrily to the plan to install this missile defense system in the former Soviet bloc country, saying it would start a new nuclear arms race. So who's the danger in the world? It's not Iran. It's the Bush government that wants to, is creating the context for a arms race again.
Yeah.
Bush is the most dangerous man in the world.
You know, Conan O'Brien, he really is a funny guy. And he said that Bush gave a speech on Saturday about Iran. And he said he just used an old speech. He just replaced the Q's with N's.
There you go. There you go. I don't know if you remember David Barsamian. It looks like David Barsamian, but he wants this to say David Barsamian.
Okay, and, so we will.
Yeah, you can go to alternativeradio.org. He just returned from Iran. He's the author of a forthcoming book called Targeting Iran. He said today, virtually everything the Bush administration has done has made things more difficult for Iranian reformers. The moderate Khatami government helped the U.S. oust the Taliban in 2001. They didn't want those, because Afghanistan is on the border of Iran, right? They didn't want those guys in there. Khatami's 2003 offer to negotiate all differences between the two countries was rebuffed. So in 2003, this moderate, fairly moderate government in Iran said, look, let's, they're internally, they're right-wing religious fanatics. I mean, like the Bush gang here in the United States. I mean, right. It's comparable like that. But neither of them. We talk about Bush Co. Having like American Taliban. They're not that bad. And the Iranians aren't that bad. They're not like Taliban religious. Some of them are. There's elements in there. But what essentially Barsamian is saying is that that Bush undercut the Iranian moderates by his refusal to negotiate, and it set the stage for Ahmadinejad to become president. Now the U.S. has two aircraft carrier groups near Iran, and the threat of an attack looms.
And I think there's a third one headed over there.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So here, you're Iran. Now, what's the history of Iran? 1953, there's a democratically elected government, right? Through the democratic process, this was, again, a region dominated by the British. This was an ex-colonial region. And this is, to begin with, what distorted the politics of the whole place. I mean, this stuff didn't just arise out of the ocean, like crazy people, like a lot of people see them. But rather, the whole region was distorted by European domination and the looting of the Middle East, the looting of Africa, the looting of Asia, to bring riches to the European colonial powers. So, actually, in Iran, there was an election. A guy named Mossadegh was elected president, and he had the idea that maybe in Iran that they could have the oil not go to the British companies, but go to the Iranian people.
Hey!
What a commie.
Yeah.
Right.
And so, what a concept.
Yeah, so the British and the United States conspired to have him overthrown. The CIA was instrumental in all this. And they installed this brutal dictatorship. It has a democratic government. The United States and Britain conspired to put in a brutal police state under royalty, under the Shah of Iran. He has this reign of 26 years in which he personally, like these dictators do, loots the country. It's run by this this brutal police apparatus called the SAVAK, S-A-V-A-K, and he has seen the Shah as the great friend of the United States. Even people like Jimmy Carter, who spent the New Year's with him, and as they always did with these dictators, toasted him as a great friend of the free world.
Oh, Jimmy.
Right? And Iran also acted as an ally of the United States on the border of the Soviet Union as this key spy center for surveillance of the Soviet Union. All right. So, this is the United States. We're 6,000 miles away, but we've got, we're overthrowing governments, installing dictatorships, and spying on the Soviet Union. So, gee, guess what? The people get real pissed off, and they seize the U.S. Embassy in 1979. They burn, they carry garbage out in the American flag, and the people of the United States are horrified. They're horrified that these people are held captive for, 430-something days,
yeah.
Whatever it was. I mean, whatever the excuse, that's absolutely unacceptable. But there are real solid reasons why Iran even despises the United States for what we've done in intervening in their region and specifically in their country and installing this regime of misery for so long. And so what's changed?
Yeah.
Here, the United States has 150,000 troops on its eastern border. It has, which in Iraq, it has, I don't know how many troops are in Afghanistan, which is its eastern border. In other words, the United States, from 6,000 miles away, has the country of Iran surrounded.
Surrounded, right.
And how do you think any nation would function? I mean, what if there was a decision by, I don't know what, like Russia, to liberate Canada and Mexico, and we were fighting, Russia was fighting the Canadian army and fighting Mexican irregulars, south of our border. I mean, don't you think that would make us just a little nervous? So there's nothing admirable about this Ahmadinejad and the rest of these right-wing religious fanatics that run Iran, but the idea that there was the desire by the part on the part of the Iranians to resolve these issues in 2003 is just par for the course. The same thing happened with North Korea. The deal that Bush just struck with the North Koreans is identical to the one that he could have struck 5 or 6 years ago, except now Korea, North Korea, has nuclear weapons. So this guy has been the worst disaster that one can ever imagine.
Yeah, tell us what you really think.
Should I tell you what I really mean? I'm holding back a little.
No, I'm with you on all of that.
Yeah.
And I think 60% of the population in the United States is with you on all of that now.
Bush also warning that that we can expect fierce fighting to flare in Afghanistan this spring. And he pressed NATO allies to provide a bigger and more aggressive force.
Now, what is that? Is he setting that up? Is that what you're saying?
Well, who knows? Where this is all going to end is beyond me. Speaking of the Nation magazine, you know, I always say that the American historic memory is about a week.
Yeah.
And then you forget everything. Like weapons of mass destruction. That's beginning to sound like Monica Lewinsky.
That blue dress.
That blue dress.
I was wondering about that dress the other day. Did she get that back?
I don't know. I bet it could go on eBay for
a lot of money.
Hey, I'm Peter Werby, and Jalene Jordan is with me, and we're at 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Here's just a little factoid, and we both just resubscribed to The Nation, right?
Yeah, The Nation magazine really is good, and they come once a week, so they pile up, but they're so full of information.
Well, here in this letter, they always have great letter exchanges between these really brainy guys. You ever notice that?
Yes.
You think, wow, man, how's he going to answer that? And but this is from Ann Jones and brainy guys and gals, I guess. And it's about this. She's commenting on this article about Afghanistan. And I forgot about this. This whole deal about a pipeline through Afghanistan.
Oh.
Remember they were calling it pipe. What is it called?
I can't remember the name, but I do.
Afghanistan or something like
remember,
that.
Remember, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, in 1997, the Taliban leaders traveled to Washington and to Texas. And remember who was the governor of Texas in 1997?
W.
Yeah, and when he wasn't executing people at a fast clip.
Oh, rapid rate.
Hey, by the way, they just, I know, I'm being... Not on target.
We're coming back to this.
They've a total of 12 people's guilt has been overturned in Houston on capital crimes. These were 12 people that were set to be executed and were found to actually be not guilty. So I wonder how many people that old W put to death.
Yeah, how about a moratorium down there?
How about a moratorium on him? Anyway, the Taliban came to Texas to discuss the pipeline with officials of the State Department and the U.S. oil conglomerate Unocal. Unocal itself disclosed that it had spent between $15 and $20 million in the initial stages of the project, including the salaries of two consultants hired to negotiate the deal. Hamid Karzai, now this is 1997,
the president of Afghanistan.
And Zalmay Khalilzad, then a Pentagon planner, later ambassador to Afghanistan and currently ambassador to Iraq.
Right, right.
I mean, it's all this racket, people.
Circle of,
Yeah. All right.
Connectedness.
Now this is
and favors.
This is going to piss me off, I can tell.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Here's Justin. Justin, hey, it's Peter and Jalene. What's up, man? Dude, turn your radio off. Get a clue. Hey.
Hello.
Hello, Justin. What's up, man? What's up?
I don't know. I just don't agree with what you're saying about the Iraqi and the communists and the, I mean, the...
What?
The Russian, the whole thing about Russia and all that.
What do you think?
It just seems to me like Peter Warby is more like a communist sympathizer.
I sound like a communist?
Yeah.
You know, damn, Justin, I'm so much more radical than that.
No, it's just not any cool. I mean, what Bush is doing is what we had to do in the first place.
Justin, you're like, talk about, you know, like, nobody thinks that anymore.
We're sitting there listening to this stuff you're saying. Just,
well, what's wrong? Give me a quick, well, good. Well, what?
I don't like Bush particularly. I think he's an idiot.
Yeah, he is an idiot.
Okay, good.
So what's the difference? I'm saying he's an idiot, too. So what's, how do we disagree?
Because, I mean, you just.
Give me one example.
Well. Bringing up what if Russia comes over and does something to Mexico and whatever, that's just crazy.
That was a hypothetical.
They're not bombing the New York Trade Centers and stuff like that.
Well, I know.
No. That was a hypothetical situation.
Also, the Iraqis didn't bomb the Trade Center either.
Let me let you talk to my buddy Ted, and you let him talk to you.
All right, Ted, go ahead.
Hello.
Ted, this is Commie Pete. You're on the air.
Hi. Well, we're just a little bit upset with Mr. Werby because he's so far left. It's unbelievable.
You're talking to him.
What's wrong with being so far left?
Well, good, I'm talking to him. I'm glad.
What's wrong with being so far left?
Well, somewhere down the middle might be a little bit more reasonable.
Oh, that's so boring.
Tell me what's... there ain't nothing in the middle of the road. There ain't nothing in the middle of the road except yellow stripes and armadillos. That's a book by... What's his name? Remember, he used to be on...
Hightower.
Jim Hightower.
Yeah, not the Hightower who works here.
No, give me one... I got to go to a spot soon, so tell me quick. Give me one thing of which you disagree with me or Jalene about.
Oh, about the fact that we as a country didn't finish the job in Iraq that we started.
Wait a minute. We didn't start it. Your friend, Justin, said that Bush is an idiot, and we all agree on that, right?
Bush is an idiot in many ways.
Yeah.
And he's, like I say, we're both Democrats. I wouldn't have voted that guy yet to save my life.
Okay. Well, we're coming closer and closer to being on the same page. Where do I or Jalene go wrong?
We're in agreement on that, for sure.
Okay.
Nevertheless, it sounds to me as I don't listen that often at night. But
go.
Okay, I believe that as a country at this point we need to follow through. I think a lot of people are so anti-war, and I'm one of them. I don't believe in war itself, but once you've started the job, you can't just abandon it.
Well. I don't know. This then could go on forever, couldn't it?
Looking back in history, I wouldn't think it would go on forever.
Well, this has gone on longer now than the Second World War.
I agree.
Yeah.
And the fact that we spent more money, we could be spending this money at home.
Well, wait a minute. I'm thinking we agree here.
I think we've had a real turn of events here.
Yes, I think we agree. Listen, we were talking about communism. We got to talk about capitalism now because we've got to do this right now. But thank you for joining us. And like I said, I think we agree more than you think.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
To love the God, to fear. And to burn the crowd that has a name, and to right or wrong, and to weak or strong, it is known to scream from the wall. I will, I walk, I will, I talk, I know, I know, I've been here before.
WRIF.com.
WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and welcome back. Jillian Jordan is with me as well.
Yes, thank you, Peter.
I'm gonna put your mic down a little lower.
Apparently, I was blaring.
Overmodulating.
Over you. That's not good.
No. Well, it's okay. It's my fault. I'm pushing the button. All right. We just heard from Justin and his buddy in Ann Arbor that said I sounded like a commie because, it turned out they were Democrats. They think Bush is an idiot. But I think what's going on here is this feeling that, it sort of tied up partly with the sense of revenge from 9/11, of which the Iraqis had nothing to do with. And certainly the Iraqi civilians had nothing to do with. And here they're expecting 1 million Iraqis are going to flee the country, flee their homes internally and leave the country. And there's hundreds of thousands of Iraqis in Jordan and Syria and Iran, and their lives have just been destroyed. The United States, Bush, because of his lies, has destroyed Iraq. And the only thing that he has as an answer is to increase the misery, increase the deaths on all sides. It's not even clear, as we said earlier, and you see that increasingly from the remarks of the men and women fighting there from the U.S., that they don't know who the enemy is.
Yeah, they're just going into homes, and I've seen things on television, some of these movies that I just can't stand watching, but sometimes it'll pop up, and these guys are like, we don't even know who we're aiming at.
Right, and they just, I'm sure that the fact that they don't know who their enemy is means they see everyone there as their enemy, and that could be true. The majority of Iraqi people want us out there, out of there. The Iraqi government does not want this surge that's going on. All right. And so anyway, Justin didn't agree with it, said I sounded like a commie. I said I was more radical than that, but whatever. Here is Chantel in Wyoming. Wyandotte. Sorry. I know the difference.
Hi. I am glad I got through because I agree with you, and I think what you said was genius about Bush, and you don't sound like a commie, and I think those Justin and his friend are jackasses myself, because when you asked them exactly why they thought you were being that way, they were kind of like,
Well, they said, yeah, I mean, listen, I do this for a living, so I'm supposed to be able to put one word after another. But although I'm not doing well, whenever people on the air start talking about how other people can't speak well, they can't do it well.
Because it has to bite you every time.
But the concern was, and I haven't heard that actually in a couple of years, that we started a job a job. This job was based on lies and misrepresentation and misassessments and everything wrong under the sun. Everything imaginably wrong was done. And to say we got to finish the job means we're going to be finishing thousands and thousands of more people's lives, destroying hundreds of thousands of people's lives. That can't go on like this.
I agree. So I completely agree with you.
All right, Chantel, thank you very much. Here is Tracy in Bloomfield. Tracy, hi. It's Peter and Jillian. You're on the air.
Hi. I actually agree with the last caller too. Every time I listen to you, I find you quite informative. Sometimes even quite funny on things that you say about the government and the way that it's going in Iraq. And I just wanted to call and let you know that I could come in the middle of a conversation and I can agree with everything that you say.
Well, I appreciate it, Tracy.
All right. You have a good night.
You too. Thank you for joining us. Now, interestingly, I thought the most interesting part of the conversation with Justin and his friend is they identified themselves as Democrats and they thought that Bush was an idiot.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was just about this war thing. But I think when and remember what he said too, the second guy, I can't remember his name, Ted, was it Ted?
Ted, I think so.
Ted said that there's well, how can you just reconcile this? On one hand, he said we have a job to do and we have to finish it. Well, it's already cost us $500 or $600 billion, over $500 trillion. They expect it's going to cost $2.2 trillion. So the idea that we can fix anything here, from roads to schools to medical care to all the problems this country has, the amount of poverty we have is just down the drain. So, but Ted said that we should be spending money here, right? So I should have asked Ted, and this is my fault, how can you justify spending all this money in Iraq? Like you say, we got to finish the job. And at the same time, think about this money that's being spent.
Yeah, and I think oftentimes, you know, people don't know those actual numbers. And when you hear those numbers, $2 trillion, for what? For nothing.
Yeah, right. This, too, auditors, billions squandered in Iraq. So let's say there is a job to do. Let's take them at their argument and say there's a job to do and should be finished, all right? Well, my contention is that we're not dealing with a government. We're not dealing with the Bush government. That this is a racket, a full-blown racket. And about $10 billion has been squandered by the U.S. government on Iraq reconstruction aid because of contractor overcharges and unsupported expenses. And federal investigators warned on Thursday that significantly more taxpayer money is at risk. The three top auditors overseeing work in Iraq told a House committee their reviews of $57 billion in Iraq contracts found that Defense and State Department officials condoned, that means allowed, repeated work delays, bloated expenses, and payments for shoddy work or work never done. Well, dear friends, you've seen the news. You watch television, I assume, and you see, do you see anything new being built in Iraq, or is it all just destruction? Where is our money going?
Yeah.
Well, it's going into the hands of
Halliburton.
Halliburton, yeah.
And right. It's subsidiaries. And you know how they do, well, you don't watch a lot of TV, but oftentimes during sweeps they do these things like on Fox or whatever where they take the cameras and secretly shoot the city workers like sleeping on a job.
Right.
I wonder how it looks in Iraq. Oh, God, can you imagine?
Well, remember that right at the point of the U.S. invasion that they shipped over, and I forgot the figure, but they were sending over these skids filled with $100 bills.
What was that for?
Well, it was Iraq money that had been held in, that they had seized.
Oh,
the assets.
From the mansions and all of that, right?
No. This was here. It was Iraqi assets in the United States.
Oh, okay.
All right. So they said, okay, we got to use this money because there's no currency. So we're, and the money just disappeared. People were bringing duffel bags and taking it.
Oh, yeah.
So this money that was, what was supposed to happen in Iraq that was being supposed to be paid for by the Iraqis, that disappeared. So we wound up paying for that as well. Let's see. John, who writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com, says, I agree with you that Bush and company are self-serving and doling out contracts, redirecting taxes to their own viewpoint and agenda. He says, how does that differ from any other administration in the last 100 years?
Yeah.
Well, it's only a matter of degree.
I think this is heights unknown. You know what I mean?
It is.
Right?
It is. In the meantime, well, you know what? There's a lot of callers. Let's, people got some things to say. All right.
That's good.
Here's Ron in North Lakeport. It's Peter and Jolene, 313-298-WRIF. Hey, Ron, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Where's North Lakeport?
Just about 5 miles north of Port Huron. You ask me that every time I come.
Busted. You know, we're going to remember
only
this
the
time.
Third time, bro.
Okay, I keep thinking. You know why? Because I keep thinking of Northport, which is on the tip of the Leelanau Peninsula past Traverse City.
Write it down, Peter.
Yeah, I write it down. I got it.
Hey, well, hey, that's all right. I'd vote for you for president anytime.
Anyways, Ron.
Hey, we're for president.
I always tell my wife, it's not going to get any better.
Hey, man, that's a sad thing, you know, as far as the government goes.
Yeah.
I can't understand why they can't get this guy out. We got the Democrats in. What's going on? Can't we stop this government we've got?
The Democrats, they're doing some things. And there's some of these committees that are beginning to investigate, like, all this money that's disappeared. Some of the corruption finally started. The Congress starting to do some oversight that the Republicans refused to do because they were part of the racket. There's also they're going to start investigating the Attorney General Gonzalez. Some of these, the whole way that torture is officially allowed in the United States. The United States is now officially a torture state. But they're all thinking about 2008. In the meantime, our money's disappearing. People are getting killed on our side. People are getting scared on their side, on the Iraqi side and the Afghan side. And a lot of the Democrats are saying, well, you know, we want to position ourselves for 2008. Well, so they're not going to. Or maybe they will. I mean, I just heard Senator Carl Levin from Michigan saying they're talking about rescinding the resolution that authorized Bush to one option being the invasion. I mean, this was not allowed. Remember, they wanted a second authorization that never came, and certainly the second authorization from the United Nations never came. So whether that's going to do anything, I don't know. I mean, one of the bills that they could put in would be that there wouldn't be any funding for the escalation that Bush is carrying out now.
Well, he's just got us into a heck of a mess and wasted money and wasted lives, and they just need to get him out.
Well, you know, Ron,
anybody that's tied with him that's going right along with the program.
Barack Obama said that the lives that were lost in Iraq were wasted. And the Republicans went crazy on that, and he apologized. And I'll tell you, I know that there's Iraq veterans listening. There could be people that have lost loved ones in Iraq. And it's pretty hard to say to them in a public manner, the way a politician or someone on the radio could say those lives were wasted. But I don't know. It's kind of hard.
As far as American lives go, going over there for an unjust cause, that was a waste to me, you know.
All right, Ron, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Appreciate your call from North Lakeport, which is just north of Port Huron.
15 miles.
15 miles north.
Oh, no, 5, I think.
5 miles north.
We'll get it right eventually.
Here's Ken in South Rockport. I know where that is. That's downriver, right? Hey, Ken.
Yeah.
You're on the air, buddy.
Okay, I'm just driving home from work.
Okay.
Disagree with you a little bit. I agree with some of the things you say, but as far as I think it's a prevention thing.
What is?
Being in Iraq, and granted, we probably stayed too long. I'm not going to argue with
that. What do you think of the prevented? You ever heard the slogan that we're making enemies faster than we can kill them?
The baby bin Ladens are just multiplying.
You know that in the Muslim world, the most common or the most prevalent name for new children is Osama. That's true.
Huh. I didn't know that.
Well, yeah. Okay.
Or Usama.
You're going to have the haters and everything else, but what are you going to do? I mean...
Well, one of the things that you shouldn't do is start a war on a Muslim nation that never did anything to the United States, that had nothing to do with 9/11, and
completely based on lies.
Yeah, and didn't have weapons of mass destruction. And what ought to be done now is fast as possible disengage from there through. I mean, this is pretty complex. I mean, Bush has created a situation where almost everybody, including us, including them, is damned if we do and damned if we don't.
Yeah, no one really knows what to do. But yeah. I do think a slow and steady. Pulling out of the troops is a good idea.
I mean, one of the things that could happen, the best thing would be to impeach Bush and Cheney, and Nancy Pelosi would become president.
Hey, and you know what? If you want Nancy Pelosi,
sure.
Right. And she would. And we're not saying we want her to be president.
Well,
it's better than Bush, though.
No, I would do every fiber in my body. And she could apologize to the Iraqi people for this invasion and destruction of their country solely based on lies, illegal under international law, and devise a way that we can bring peace in that region. Bush wants war. Bush wants oil. Bush wants military bases. And you can't have peace with that as a goal.
She seems to be challenging Bush pretty heftily. I don't know how far that's going to go, though. I don't have a ton of hope for her.
Well, we'll see. They're doing, on some regard, the Democrats are doing a little better than I thought. But in the main, they don't want to. I mean, they're hedging their bets the way that Hillary did in 2002 when she voted, and Kerry and Edwards, voted for the war resolution because they had presidential aspirations, so they didn't want to be seen as somebody that voted against it. Now, who looks good? They look terrible. The Democratic base is just pillaring Hillary. That's pillaring Hillary.
Oh, wow, that was...
which she deserves. And people that voted against the war resolution, like our Senator Levin and like our Michigan Senator Debbie Stabenow, they're the ones that look like they knew what they were doing.
Yeah, that's true. That's all very right. True.
All right, here is Travis in Fowlerville. I know where that is, just south of Lansing, right?
That would be it.
Yeah, so I know most places.
My only concern is I am Republican.
Really? All right. Okay, good. I mean, I didn't know they existed anymore.
I disagree with what Bush is doing. I do not agree with this war. I've lost three very good friends to this war.
Oh, boy.
If I was still in, I would have been over there with my unit, and those are where my three friends got lost at. So I'm not for this war. We're over there pointlessly.
What makes you a Republican? Why are you a Republican? Defines you?
Would you like the honest answer to that?
Is it
my
money?
My family background. No, it's a family background.
Okay. Because I have that family background, too, but I was able to kind of, I don't know, recover.
Okay. That's just the route that I took. I do agree with some stuff, but I disagree with this war. But one of my problems with it is the fact that if we did pull out now, what about possible repercussions from that? Like us showing them a sign of weakness and then them turning around and coming back at us anyway.
Well, how are they going to come? Listen, whoever, we don't even know who they are. They could be like maybe 1,000 people in the whole world, but we see what 19 people can do, the kind of damage they can bring on our country. So what is stopping terrorist acts in this nation now is police work and security and everything that has been put in place after this catastrophic failure, the Bush administration, that allowed 9/11 to occur. But in other words, nothing, that end of things, nothing would be any different. It's not like they're going to take all of a sudden get this army and attack us. Just like the idea that Iran would attack the United States or attack Israel or attack a country in Eastern Europe is absurd. They would be obliterated. They would be wiped off the face of the earth. I've said about 1,000 times on this show, Iran knows from the North Korean example and the Iraq example, if you don't have weapons of mass destruction and the United States doesn't like you, you get invaded. If you do have them the way North Korea does, they say, hey, can we send you a couple hundred tons of fuel oil?
Yes, I agree with that. But I'm worried about another 9/11, not a war.
Well,
invading us or trying to invade us.
Well, of course, and we should. There's a lot of people out there that are willing to act out their politics in an absolutely unacceptable way, the destruction of civilian life. And that, well, I just really said it, that we, whether we're in Iraq or out of Iraq, that same problem could still exist. And what we have to do is there have to be vigilance, security, police work, intelligence, all of that. That's going to go on. It's not like they're going to say, hey, we drove them out of Iraq. And what's the option? To stay in there and piss more people off, kill more people, lose more people like the soldiers that you knew and probably loved, lose more of them. I mean,
I agree with that.
Bush has got us. We both said that. Bush has got us in a position where we're pretty much damned if we do and damned if we don't.
Yes, he does. Very much so.
All right. Thank you so much. I appreciate it, Travis. And, man, I mean, you know, there's everyone's, you know, I saw in the New York Times list the dead. And I just saw before there was some memorial for him here in the Detroit area from a young man from Shelby Township. And I almost don't want to look at it because I know friends of ours, two of them have children that are in Iraq.
Friends there, yeah, and I have a friend who, very close friend of mine, her brother is over there. He just got moved to Mosul. And every Sunday morning on the George Stephanopoulos program, they do a segment where it's just music and then they have the names of the service folks who have died that week. And every week I just lose it, including this morning.
Well, I keep thinking one of these days I'm just going to see. You know, it's funny. Today, I was preparing for the show, and I heard this shout in anguish, and I still don't know what it was from. I mean, I hope I'm wrong, and all of a sudden I had this thought. Maybe it was my neighbor's kid.
Oh.
He just learned. I mean, it was absolutely preposterous. There was no real reason that I would think that. But, you know, you never know in life and civilian life and just your own life, you never know what card's being turned up. And certainly in war, you know, the deck gets shuffled and dealt a lot quicker.
Oh, yeah.
All right, we'll be right back. Peter Werbe, Jalene Jordan, 313-298-WRIF.
Weekday night at 10 with Meltdown. It's like getting hit in the head by a 2x4 with a nail in it. Mandatory Metallica. Now, it's your triple play of the mighty Metallica with a big unit every weekday night at 10, exclusively from your one and only Metallica station, 101-WRIF. Everything that rocks. This is WRIM.com.
And during the few moments that we have left, we want to talk right down to earth in a language that everybody here can easily understand.
back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome to our second hour. The second hour here of Night Call brought to you by Waking Up, Metro Detroit Sweatshop Free Clothing Store, located in the Universal Mall at 12 Mile Road in DeQuinder in Warren. You can go to wakingupstore.com. You can call us at 313-298-WRIF. Call TalkYes at yahoo.com. And if I didn't, did I say who us was?
You didn't.
Okay. Jolene Jordan
that
is with me.
That phantom voice over
yes.
there.
Yes. And you can go to our websites, Jolene, J-U-L-I-N-E, Jordan.com, or Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E.com. God, remember, if you would have married me, you would have had to spell both your names.
You're right.
There you go. Anyway, we're talking about Iraq again. But let me just talk about this. I was telling Jolene before the show that I was partying last night. And actually, I didn't even tell you that. I told you we were bar hopping, right?
Inferno. Right. You're much more wild than me these days, Peter.
It's true. These two bars are pretty close to one another. And we had drinks in both of them. We had a bunch of us, right? So
yeah.
We would go down and hear Even Exchange at this one bar. And I can't remember the blues band. Oh, these guys would kill me.
Yeah.
At the other. So we were just going back and forth. But before that, we went to this benefit for this UAW local in Elkhart, Indiana. And so it's, what do they make? UAW? Auto parts? No. They are on strike against Con-Selmer. Con-Selmer makes brass instruments. Yeah, Selmer, like trumpets and trombones. And they manufacture these handmade, expensive Vincent Bach Stradivarius professional music trumpet and trombones.
Wow.
So, and they've been out on strike for almost a year. They were, it's owned by, what's the piano company?
I guess with an S. Steinway?
Steinway, yeah. And Steinway has been bought by this corporate raider. And so what he's trying to do, here's union employees. He's trying to cut their wages by a third. Right?
A third.
They want to have for their health benefits a $16,000 deductible. In other words, you have to pay everything up to $16,000. Yeah. And we were talking earlier about this. Justin said I sounded like a communist. Here is what, and the man's name is Dana Messina. And if I'm not going to go on about him, but some people, if they follow this stuff, know who it is. And they said, isn't it ironic that, that the union, the UAW union, is fighting to maintain and promote a system that President Reagan helped abolish in the name of democracy and capitalism. And we heard these people at the UAW local, what was it, 174 or something. It was Walter Reuther's old West Side local out in Romulus. Actually, you're in this union hall, you look up and all of a sudden there's airplanes, like five, you know, big 747s 500 feet above your head. They're landing.
Oh,
you know, right, yeah, right to Metro Airport. But anyways, these people, I mean, I would alternately get so angry at what's being done to these people. And they had the kind of American pride in their work for American products. They were talking about, I worked here for 27 years. And one woman said, well, I'm a newbie. I've only worked at this plant in Elkhart for 12 years.
Whoa,
and,
newbie, huh?
Yeah. So essentially, too, that the company is telling them either you accept this contract or we're going to take our manufacturing to China.
That's an insane contract. And these people, they live their whole lives doing this job,
yeah.
And all of a sudden, bam.
And they're so proud. They were so proud of their work because, you know, they actually have the right to be proud. Yeah, it's craftsmanship. And they were turning out something like 250 instruments a day, and they've got scab labor in there now, and they're turning out like 20.
You know, no kidding.
Yeah. So they're holding on because it's that always union busting costs companies, depending on how big they are, anything from thousands to millions. But it's an investment because they can drive down the price of labor.
In the end.
And yeah. And does it screw individual people? Does it hurt families? And these are all Republicans, of course, right? And they're talking about family values. And so Chrysler is laying off 13,000 people. I mean, do the math on that. How many people just even if there's three people in a family, actually can't, what is it, 26, about 40,000 people, a lot of them in this area, closing factories, and on the other hand, we're being told all the time, the economy is just doing great. What about these people? These geniuses that are scheduling these layoffs, these mass firings, essentially, they're wealthy.
You know, I've heard some blame to the tree huggers.
What's that?
To us crazy tree huggers.
Oh, no.
That the environmental movement and the move toward more environmentally sound vehicles is part of the problem.
That's not...
This is what they're saying.
You know, the they isn't this guy that works here, is it?
No. No, it's not. No. Daimler Chrysler.
Yeah. Oh, no, they said that?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
The rising labor costs, foreign automobile competition, and the environmental movement.
Oh, gee. So, but that's typical, we're talking about communism, typical capitalist blackmail, that you have to let us pollute the planet or it's going to hurt the economy. That's what Bush says about the Kyoto Accords. It'll hurt the economy. Well, one of the things these people have to do is they have to get less return on their investment and let the wealth flow to the people who produce it. In this case, the people that are doing the horns or the UAW workers that make the cars. I mean, these guys in Detroit here in the automobile industry have made one bad decision after another. And you know, all these corporate execs, they're still rich. They still have their big houses. They drive their big fancy cars. And it's always the person, whether they're making a trombone or a Chrysler, they still make Newports?
You know what? I don't know, Peter.
I had a Chrysler Newport. In a 1974 Chrysler Newport.
Really?
Yeah, that was my favorite car.
Rock on.
I think I had it in the late 80s, though.
I remember you had, what was that station wagon you had for about many years? The blue one.
Oh, an Oldsmobile.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
That was an old one.
My favorite car, though, was I had a 1969 Ford Gran Torino.
Ah.
Yeah, that was a cool one.
Very
convertible.
Cool.
Convertible.
Ooh, Peter. Yeah. Did you cruise in it?
I cruised. I should have kept it. It's actually, it turned out they made 5,500 of these cars, which is...
That was it, huh?
Very limited edition. Yeah. Oh, well. Everybody. Okay. Let's go back to our calls. So here's Jeff waiting patiently in Toledo. I know where that is as well. Jeff, hi. It's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air.
How you doing, guys?
Doing well. Thanks for waiting.
Good to talk to you. Listen, this is when Justin was it that called, when his friend was on the phone, and they called you communist and the whole... Look, you got to understand this. They don't understand, and this is the problem, that they just don't understand. This whole heist that Bush pulled could never have happened. Never. If people didn't go, grab your flag, run outside, freak out, dust to the towel heads, the whole thing. Look, this is the thing. People don't understand. Point A to point B is the only thought process that they're supposed to have.
Well, you're being kind, Jeff, that there's a thought process. Mostly it is just responding in the manner that you're supposed to authority. Authority speaks through the official medium, which is television, and the leaders, the authorities above us, the authorities invested with all the power, it appears, in this society, and they, being good citizens, model citizens, say, yes, we will repeat the thoughts of the leader.
But you have to think to keep a free society at all.
Oh, yeah, of course.
You have to. And see, this is the thing, though. Like, for instance, we have these new parochial schools that have been built here, right down the street from me, as a matter of fact. And when they were advertising these schools, these are the Heritage Foundation schools.
These right-wing...
These heritage schools, yes.
Yeah, they're actually from the Heritage Foundation. This is a right-wing non-think tank.
It's a heritage academy.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
And it's amazing because I don't have any kids, but they kept sending us, probably, you know, the neighborhood, everybody, got these brochures from them. And they were unbelievable. I mean, if you look at them, the kid, they have a motif of a child, you know, that's holding the flag. And he's got his backpack and, you know, like, looked like Lederhosen. What was really weird about it was this. I had seen pictures, you know, previously. I have a lot of World War II books. And I have pictures of the Hitler Youth. And this motif was very strangely close. I mean, you know, the Aryan kid with the flag. It was unbelievable.
Singing, "Tomorrow Belongs to Me."
It was unbelievable.
Well, that's what's the name of those schools? What do they call them? The madras? Is that what it is? These Taliban schools? Yeah, I mean, if the way you want to reproduce people that are loyal to the leader is to have authoritarian education and to rather than training people to think for themselves. And although this is a allegedly democratic country, it uses its educational mechanisms in a manner that wants to instill in people this automatic loyalty to power and officialdom and to authorities above the common people. Well, that's not the democratic ideal.
Exactly.
And the beginning, like in the 1960s, when this all began to fall apart, when people began thinking for themselves and thinking as a methodology, following orders wasn't the way to go, but rather to think, as you're saying, think for yourself. That's when they got the idea, that we had to have these special schools. So it's come to this, has it?
Yes. Wow. And to see that kind of separation that went down in the 60s is sort of the same kind of separation you see now without the Hendrix and the lava lamp. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But it's sort of the same type of thing. But this is the thing. And this is what people have to understand.
Well, you're right. Well, thank you for that. I'm going to look further. Heritage schools, huh? And like I say, the Heritage Foundation, a right-wing non-think tank. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate it. And let's go to Lars. Lars is in Madison Heights. Hi, you're Peter and Jolene. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
First thing I want to say, next time someone tells you, like, you're a communist, go to China, you say, well, if you don't like whiny liberals, you can move to Singapore.
Okay. There you go.
But, yeah. I'm a former Marine. I got out about 8 months ago. My old unit just got back from Iraq last Friday.
Really?
Wow. And some of the guys I keep in touch with, they said that they're already planning the next deployment.
Spell that a little.
They just got back.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, their next deployment.
Like last Friday. Like, it's like even during the deployment, they're already talking about the next deployment.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the bills. I think it's Representative Murtha wants to put in that there has to be a certain amount of specified time in between these tours.
I heard that it's supposed to be about 6 months now.
What is it now? Or is it anything?
I heard that there's like a federal law that says that you have to be back for 6 months before you can deploy the same unit again.
Yeah, but has that been the case, though, now?
Well, I'm not sure, because in Marine Corps we'll have, like, basically after deployment, all the guys who are contracts are up, they get out and go home. Then you have a couple weeks of downtime, and then you'll have to start the training build-up again and get new recruits from School of Infantry, who just graduated boot camp like 2 months earlier, and then you have to train them with the unit and get them up to speed, and go to special schools and courses, and then you have like 2 weeks at home, then you come back, and then you go on deployment.
Well, you know what's happening, and you may have experienced this yourself in your units. The Army and the Marine Corps are letting in more recruits with criminal records, including some with felony convictions. And, drug offenses, serious misdemeanors, and they're getting the number of Army and Marine recruits needing waivers for these has doubled since last year alone.
Yeah, I heard that at a first sergeant SOI, and he used to say, talk about the Marine Corps in the 80s, that was like when they hired Marines who were from, or recruited Marines who had like criminal records and stuff, and they're saying like, the duty NCO, when he walks into a barracks, he'd have his pistol drawn. Otherwise, someone would try to knock him out and then pawn it.
Well, the other thing is there's, I think the figure is 30,000 non-citizens that are in Iraq that they've been told this is a fast track to citizenship. That's sort of like the gangs in New York. Remember that? You got off the boat from Ireland, and the next thing you know, you're in the Army. All right, Lars, thanks for your experiences. I appreciate them. And let's see here.
We're glad you're out.
Yeah, indeed. And so we went from Lars, who was a Marine, to Brad, who is in Marine City. Hey, Brad, you're on the air.
Hey, Peter, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I just wanted to start off by kind of continue on with what Lars was saying. I have a buddy of mine who just went into the Marines. He's scheduled to go to Iraq in the next couple of months. He was actually, my buddy had, he was scheduled to go to court for a felony breaking and entering, and the Marines, they expunged his record upon his enlistment. And I also know that once he gets back, he's scheduled to receive a check for, like, I think, $14,000.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, you know, if part of, you know, the money that Bush, you know, has conveniently redirected is to going to, you know, to paying these, you know, these types of people, you know, like my friend, who unfortunately are not, you know, the highest standing members of society, you know, to go and serve in this war, which we all know is dishonest and, you know, wrong. And,
well, it does have that feel of a mercenary force when they're, I mean, I think you can get as much as $20,000 for joining.
It could be as much as that, I think, if you make multiple tours, yeah. I also think that that part of the problem with this war also is that another call I touched on it earlier is that we are, in the process, we're creating so many enemies. I almost feel as if, you know, Bush has created such a mess that in a weird way, it's almost like we have to stay and clean it up so as, you know, we don't cause problems for ourselves in other countries, you know, as we know that, you know, that we could have problems, you know, we have troops in pretty much every country in the world, you know, if, you know, part of this, you know, anti-American movement moves to other countries, that could cause problems for our troops.
Well, it's already there. I mean, the United States is hated all across the Muslim world, and there's a negative opinion of us in most of the European countries. But think about Germany and the United States, or Germany and Japan. I mean, certainly we're all pretty much pals now. But things have to be settled. And Bush shows no sign of wanting to settle any of that. And here, I'm going to go to another call. But thank you, because I think here that John in St. Clair Shores wants to know what's the solution, right?
Yeah, I mean, everyone's talking about the problem, and I'm asking sincerely, not rhetorically. If you were president or speaker of the House or whatever, what's the solution? What's the next step? How do we solve this problem?
There's any number of solutions have been put forth by Democrats, including Murtha, Representative Murtha, the Marine, you know, the ex-Marine, who began, what, a year and a half ago now, talking about a phased withdrawal. I forgot who it was that, Senator Levin, Carl Levin of Michigan, talked about a manner in which the United States could get out of the main combat roles. I mean, Iraq doesn't want us to do this. The Iraqi people don't want us in there. I mean, what would happen if all of a sudden we packed everybody up and just took off to Saudi Arabia tomorrow? I don't know. I mean, we may have created the context for a horrible situation. I mean, look at Vietnam. United States lost that war, got driven out, and you think, oh, well, finally they're going to have peace. And then the Khmer Rouge comes to power in Cambodia, and another million people are killed. Well, that context was set by the lies of Johnson and the lies of Bush and the of Nixon. And Nixon's refusal to face reality, much in the same way Bush is. So it gets back into that. I mean, that's what I want to say to Bush. What's the solution? And he's going to tell me 20,000 more troops in Baghdad?
Yeah, no.
I know. So there could be a manner in which the United States could announce that it is no longer going to be involved in offensive warfare in Iraq, that it wants a coalition of people within the region. See, that's why, I mean, Bush refuses to talk to Iran. I mean, why would he do that? The United States is not at war with Iran. Iraq and Iran, the Iraqi government is essentially a Shiite government, and Iran is Shiite, that if some kind of situation that there could be a peacekeeping force of Muslim countries, or even from ones in the area, joint Sunni-Muslim or Sunni-Shiite force. I mean, something. These bright guys from the Pentagon and the State Department and the White House got us into this. Let them think about getting us out, because they have screwed everything up. What is it? What's the thing? FUBAR.
Yeah,
fouled up, although that's not the word you usually use.
Right.
Fouled up beyond all recognition. And then, you know, they say, well, hey, what's the solution? They're asking me? All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. But that's the key question. What is the solution? Here's Jim in Dearborn. Jim, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. I'm Peter Werby. Jalene Jordan is with us as well. Go ahead.
Well, actually, I have the solution.
Okay.
But first, you got me going when you were talking about the union.
Yeah.
And because all you hear about is how Granholm is demonized because she wants businesses to actually pay taxes for the infrastructure they use.
Right.
And so they're saying, well, that's why all these jobs are leaving. But who's the head of the National Association of Manufacturers?
Tell us.
John Engler.
Is that right?
And all the manufacturing jobs are leaving.
Well, he's the guy that set the context for the ex-governor of Michigan, the Republican, for situation being so screwed up. So that's where he landed. I mean, after all of his service to the corporations of Michigan, they just reward him. I mean, all these racketeers are the same. They all land on their feet. You know, the guy that was in charge of making up all the lies in about the Iraq war that must have known that none of this was true, Doug Feith, he had landed a $500,000 contract to do this and that. And fortunately, though, that rug finally got pulled out from under him. But it's, just everywhere you look, no matter how badly these guys screw up, they always land on their feet and on top of people. But
when they screw up, they're helping someone out at the same time.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
I do have a solution to end the war.
Sure, what's that?
Because in the whatever, if you want to call it the government that they have in Iraq, whatever it is, but there are, it's mostly Shiites, but there are Sunnis and Kurds too.
Right.
So you get the government together and you say, look, you come up with a way to share power. You come up with, so you guys aren't fighting each other. And as soon as you come up with a plan, 30 days, we're out of the country. All the American businesses are out of the country. All the military's out of the country, the mercenaries, and we're going to pay reparations so you can rebuild your own country.
Well, I think it has to be something like that. I mean, there's no way that we can get out of the responsibility for the damage that the Bush racket has done to Iraq. And the cost, as I've said before, is going to be $2.1 trillion. And even if we left tomorrow, what we owe those people, what we owe the veterans, the damage that's been done to them, the medical costs that are going to be ongoing. And think about an 18-year-old that's lost his legs in Iraq. That means if he lives to be 80 years old, that he's going to be getting VA care for that whole period, unless Bush cuts back on it even more than he already has.
And can I make one more comment?
Sure, go ahead.
You know how they say when you talk about that we should leave Iraq, and they say, well, you're emboldening our enemies. I think the fact that George Bush is making the decisions emboldens our enemies more than anything else.
I agree 100%. Nothing has emboldened them like Bush's failed assault on Iraq. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate the call. Here is Mike. Mike's in Roseville. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing good.
I love your show.
Thank you.
First off, I think of that movie from 1952, I don't know, about the quote in there was, we're not concerned with your petty squabbles now that you're experimenting in nuclear power and able to send rockets out of our atmosphere. Now interstellar safety is at risk.
I remember that well, one of my favorite films.
Yeah, but I heard that...
Is that Soylent Green?
I don't know. Hey, can you turn your radio completely off?
Sure.
Yeah, because we're on, I don't know, it used to be a 7-second delay. Sounds like we're on a 30-second delay or something like that. Anyway, you don't remember the name of the film, huh? It's slipping my mind as well, I have to say.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites.
Yeah. Not Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis.
No.
Okay.
No.
Yeah.
There's supposed to be some kind of agreement that before the war, there's an agreement to rebuild the other's country after we tear it down. Is that true?
I don't know.
There was no plan. Remember that?
Yeah. No, they didn't have any plan.
There was no plan.
Yeah. Well, maybe someone else can remind us of what that film is. But
yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for that. This just popped up, this Join the March on the Pentagon, which, Jolene Jordan, you're going to Saturday, March 17th in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
Did I say on the air that I thought there could be as few as 5 or 10,000 people there? Because this wasn't like I think it's going to be a lot more.
This is going to be a big one.
Yeah, but not as big as the 500,000 that showed up on, what was the date, January 27th.
Right. Is that how many? Oh,
that's what they say now. Yeah. I mean, geez, if the New York Times or whatever can say 90,000, which was preposterous.
Well, I've marched, you know, a lot of places in D.C. so far, but I've never marched to the Pentagon. So this will be something new, and I will give a firsthand report. I'm going for 24 hours, and I'll be back in time for this show.
Good. And, a firsthand report.
And a nap.
Now, if they bring, like, National Guardsmen out, are you going to put, like, flowers in the barrel of their guns?
Hell no.
Well, remember,
Peter, you're the one who taught me how to not get arrested. Yeah, not in the criteria.
Actually, this is the 40th anniversary of the March on the Pentagon. The first one, where that, I don't know, is that a common image? I think it is from that era.
Where they put the flowers in there?
Yeah, is it?
I don't know. Not for me, but
flower children.
You know. Oh well, sure. Oh, that is. I thought you meant the actual image of the putting the flower in the gun barrel.
That's what I meant. I have a postcard at my house.
You do.
With this young woman just putting this flower.
You know, I would love to do that, but they are so hungry to spray us. pepper spray.
Yeah. And what do they have that ray gun?
Oh, yeah, that makes it feel like your skin is on fire. Burning.
Yeah, you're right.
I'm going to pass. I'm going to pass on all that.
You know, this is interesting. And this is fine. Everybody that's waiting wants to talk about the war. I didn't think, different subject. But everyone else wants to talk about the war.
Well, you know what? That really is dominating not only the mainstream media, but this show.
I have this whole sheath of paper, and it says women's issues, and it's about abortion, and
these guys are like, please don't.
Yeah. Right. Okay. The whole thing about the cervical cancer vaccine in Texas that they're going to require. Actually, it's happening.
And 20 states are planning on requiring that.
Michigan. Yeah. It turns out that.
Oh, really? Michigan.
Yeah. In Texas, Governor Rick Perry recently issued an order that girls be vaccinated, but some legislators are trying to overturn the order, with some opponents complaining because the governor's former chief of staff is now a lobbyist for Merck, the pharmaceutical company. I mean, it is all such a blatant racket.
It really is.
Yeah.
Big, ugly racket.
So part of the problem is you can't sort it out. You can't sort out what's actual necessity because the juice is always flowing. Now, in Illinois, a bill introduced by a legislator who had the virus HPV is that intended to prevent prompted a conservative group's blog to speculate that she had been promiscuous.
Oh, of course
she was doing the dirty deed. Hey, what year is this? What century? What are these people?
How tight are you?
Anyway, but it turns out that this woman who is a legislator, she's the director of Women in Government, a national association of state legislators that has embraced the fight against cervical cancer. Isn't that good? Guess what?
Connect the dot for me.
They're funded by Merck.
They're evil.
They are. It is such a racket. All right, we'll be right back. Peter and Jolene, 313-298-WRIF.
This is WRIF.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome to our final segment. Joining me in the studio, Jalene Jordan. And let's see. We'll have to decide. Who will I play at? Okay, we'll do William Rivers Pitt, because we're talking a lot about the Iraq War. He's written a book called House of Ill Repute, Reflection on War, Lies, and America's Ravaged Reputation. All this, by the way, is on my website, peterwerby.com, W-E-R-B-E.com. You can go to Jalene's, J-U-L-I-N-E, so it looks like Juline. You don't mind me saying that, do you?
No.
Okay. Jalene Jordan, and because people always spell it wrong, don't they?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's a very unusual name.
The people call you Jalene sometimes, don't they?
They call me everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then at 1:30 Eastern Time, Ali Abu Nima, who's written One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Impasse. He's calling for one single country that would be essentially what it began as, Palestine, essentially. All right, let's go back to our phone calls, 313-298-WRIF. Here is Alyssa in Canton. Hi, Alyssa. It's Peter and Jalene.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Jalene. How are you guys doing tonight?
Doing good.
Great.
Good. I was listening to your guys' show probably, I would say, about 4 days ago, and a guy called in and talked about the HPV in Texas. And then you just mentioned it a little bit ago.
Oh, yeah.
I don't understand how they can require it. For how old? Well, how old do you have to be?
12 or something they want to
do. Wow, what?
Yeah.
The flu shot isn't even required. How can that be?
Well, isn't vaccination, though, for, like, smallpox and measles and stuff like that? That's required.
But there's so many opt-out. You can still opt out. Like, I mean, yeah. People are still going to get out of this if they don't want to. If they don't want their young daughter to do it, which I know a lot of parents are going, like, not going to approve of that. I mean, if over a certain age, when it can actually start causing problems, I think it's actually a good idea. But for 12, that's...
I think it should be up to the mother and the daughter and the father. You know, I mean, I think that's we need to leave this up to the parents.
Right. It's totally about them. It's their children. Like, it's not.
Well, you know, Alyssa, this Governor Rick Perry of Texas, I'm sure he's against sex education in the schools, and I'm sure he's probably against information about condoms. So if people had, if young people had proper protected sex, that's not an issue then. I mean, that's hard for me to sort out. I obviously don't like being an anti-authoritarian, don't like the idea of the state telling parents you have to have your kid vaccinated. For one thing, this stuff has not been around, the vaccination has not been around a real long time.
So they don't even know what it could do or any possible harmful effects of it or anything?
Well, I mean, it's been approved. I'm not.
They probably have a list of side effects, and that's about it. And we don't know.
You know, HPV, which is the virus that can cause cervical cancer, and it can cause. It doesn't automatically cause it. That someone said that it means help pay for Vioxx. Now, Vioxx was the painkiller that Merck had to take off the market and had all these.
Oh, they were making so much money off of it.
Hundreds of millions of dollars in costs that they had to pay. So HPV means help pay for Vioxx. But
I haven't heard that
beautiful.
One.
That's of course. That's where I'm coming to. I'll tell you.
I got you. All right, Alyssa, thank you very much. Thanks for joining us at 313-298-WRIF.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Let's see. Where are we going here? We should go to Southfield and talk to Bill. Bill, you're on the air with Peter and Jalene. Go ahead.
Well, thank you to the both of you for taking my call.
Please.
I'd like to help you sort out this Iraq war.
Go ahead.
Great.
last year, about 40,000 Americans were killed and automobile accidents.
Okay.
This is a holy war. This is a war between Jesus and Muhammad.
I don't think so, Bill.
Wait.
This is a war about oil. This is a war about what they call domination of natural resources.
We will destroy the barbarians because Jesus is Lord.
I think we're gonna end this call. Thanks, Bill. Well, you know what? I was thinking here. I don't know whether Al. You know, we always say we're not giving Al his props, are we?
Al, who answers the phones when you call 313-298-WRIF.
Yeah.
And he rocks on the phone.
He does.
He's fabulous.
Yeah, his nickname is Slayer.
And now he knows what HPV is.
Yeah. His nickname is Slayer because he likes the band Slayer so much.
He's a metalhead, Al is. And, in fact, he's going to be on the air at 2 in the morning.
That's right. Yeah. After we do our hour of...
interviews.
Yeah. Well, I was just looking. He put up on the screen. I don't know if he was saying this but or a caller, but he says the movie that that one caller was trying to think about was The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Oh.
But I don't, I mean, I don't think so.
Okay. I haven't seen it.
Yeah, that was the thing with the robot, with the guy comes with the robot.
Oh, I really have, I haven't seen
it. Very cool movie.
I could sit here and pretend, but I haven't seen it.
Yeah, well, it's one of these 50s science fiction films.
Yeah, okay, well, that's, yeah, I'm not a big science fiction person.
Well, I just saw When Worlds Collide, there's this huge planet that's going to hit the world and kills everybody except for a few thousand people.
Oh, my.
And they all take off in a rocket ship and go to another planet. it's like a happy ending, right?
I hope it's a nice planet.
Well, it is. Turns out, they don't even know for sure, but it turns out when they land there, it's a nice planet, but I'm thinking, didn't they just lose about 2 billion people back on Mother Earth? Oh, well.
Oh my.
Wars between Jesus and Muhammad. I don't, you know, isn't that, didn't they call it the Crusades? You know, we always say, what year is this? What millennium is this?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, yeah, that was like popular. That view was popular about 1100.
Well, some people do believe it, though, Peter.
They do. They're part of the problem.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what I would say. Here's Dushan in Detroit. Hi, Dushan. You're on the air.
Yeah, I wanted to know about what you was talking about with the judges and taxes about. Did you saying Bush had something to do with that?
Which point? I sort of missed what you said.
When you was talking about them, they let go 12 prisoners.
Oh, the execution. Yeah, I think it was in Houston that there was just a 12th person that was exonerated who had been convicted of capital crime and was about to be executed.
And you saying Bush had something to do with that?
No.
We were talking about Bush because he spent many years as governor of Texas killing all kinds of, possibly, some innocent men and women.
Yeah. Well, he was the governor, and he had he could have granted a clemency to any of them, and didn't. In fact, he holds the record for signing more death warrants than any governor in the history of the United States.
And the reason why I was asking about that is because I wanted to know, how far do y'all deal with on the issue of judicial and prosecutorial misconduct?
Well, it's pretty high, and we come to find out, gee, I'm sure this will be a big surprise to people, that the poorer you are, the more chance there is of prosecutorial and judicial misconduct, as you're saying.
Yeah, well, I know about it pretty well, and I was wondering, did y'all ever speak on the issue of a case called Lane Sassauer that had something to do with Hillary Clinton and John Conyers?
I missed that now.
What happened was that it was a woman, she has a organization called Judicial Accountability.
Okay.
And she went to a meeting where Hillary Clinton and John Conyers was there to post to appoint a judge there. Now, the judge that she went to complain about had a history of misconduct.
Okay.
And when she went to the meeting, they asked her at the meeting, before the meeting started, if anybody have anything they want to say, come and say it. So she came to say it, they arrested her for disturbing the meeting. Then when she tried to subpoena John Conyers and Hillary Clinton to come as witnesses, they had the subpoena squashed.
Yeah, it's hard to get those people into local courts on things like that. Well, it sounds like she got a raw deal. I mean, I don't know. Don't know all the facts of it, but...
Yeah, sounds pretty involved, but unfortunate for her. Huh?
All right, maybe you can email me, Dushan, because, these cases are kind of complex, and it's hard to get them across on radio in a simple manner. If you can always email me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. All right. Thanks for it. Appreciate it. Here is Mike. Mike's in Novi. Mike, hi. You're on the air.
Hey there. How are you?
Good.
Good. This is kind of old news just because I haven't been able to get, haven't been near a phone the last couple of weeks, but John Edwards was on, I think, Meet the Press last week or the week before.
Right.
And, naturally he was raked over the coals because he kind of laid down the first plank in his platform being healthcare. And, how are you going to pay for it? And
And I apologize for not having the exact number that he threw out there, but I want to say it was something in the $80 to $90 billion a year range.
Yeah.
And, oh, my gosh, they're going to have to raise taxes to do that. Well, the last time I checked, we're involved in a war right now where we're actually spending more than that per year, and we're cutting taxes.
Uh-huh.
So I'm confused.
Well, I think the people running things are confused as well. It doesn't make a lot of sense, to be sure. This is unheard of, in fact, in history. Always during wars, taxes are raised. But Bush's agenda is, for one thing, transfer of money through the government, you know, taking our taxes and turning it over to his buddies in the war industries and the reconstruction industries, and also to alleviate their tax burden, something you know, that they sure don't need. So I think we're all confused about that, Mike. All right, thank you very much. You know what I've forgotten to do, Jolene, is take emails. Tom in Ann Arbor, along with tons of other people, say, in fact, that the movie he was talking about was The Day the Earth Stood Still. Matt says that.
So I should be checking this out?
Well, it's a very cool movie, actually.
I have Netflix. I can get just about anything.
Wait a minute. Joe says the guy's quoting from the movie War of the Worlds.
Oh.
Which,
okay, well, Speed On with Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
I did see that. Now, I really didn't have a whole lot of interest in that, but I did watch it. Kind of glued to it.
P-Funk says that it's The Day the Earth Stood Still as well. And let me see. Your reference sites. What is this? Could you please let me know some of your internet news sites that you view? Also, any other sites of interest for news truth, not only happening in America, but in the world.
You have a whole section on your website on peterwerby.com, right?
Yeah. Randy. Well, I mean, you can either do that, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerby.com, or you can go to truthout.org.
Yeah, buzzflash.com.
Commondreams.org.
TheNation.com is another one.
Or counterpunch.org.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Boy, I haven't been to that one for a long time.
But you know, there's just so much.
So much information.
So much to read, so little time.
But read the more the better.
Yeah.
Right? With the right resources.
Right. Here's Adam in Hazel Park. Adam, hi, you're on the air. Hey, Adam, you with me? Wait a minute. Adam, he's gone. All right. Well, we could actually talk about some of these other things, although Al is talking to people. How about this? Talk about all the issues of importance. A Republican state representative in Tennessee has introduced legislation that would require death certificates for aborted fetuses.
You know,
I'm just pulling her chain because I can sit
unbelievable.
Back. Yeah, unbelievable.
Yeah, what's going on with this guy in Tennessee? You know,
well,
it's bad enough they want to regulate my body, and then they want to regulate my fetus.
Yeah, you know that Tennessee's got a lot of problems, like a lot of states. They had this fairly decent state health program, and they've had to cut tens of thousands of poor people off it.
Oh.
So what's this jerk off do? You know, this is this is where he's
worried
at.
About that. He's worried about was that the state where the guy had the Ten Commandments, or was that Alabama?
That was Alabama.
Okay,
right below it.
The state house, right?
Is Alabama below Tennessee? I think so. But anyway, Republican presidential candidate John McCain, looking to improve his standing with the party's right-wing voters, said the court decision that legalized abortion should be overturned. He wants to overturn. He says it should be overturned, Roe versus Wade.
McCain he's definitely gone off the deep end. He's just out there warmongering, and now he's talking about...
Well, he's an opportunist like most politicians.
He is. He wants to get elected, and this is exactly what he's doing.
Well, you know who votes? You know who votes in the primaries is the part, you know, the real hardcore of the Democrats and the Republicans.
Yeah.
So he knows that it's the conservatives in the Republican Party that are going to control who gets nominated.
Yeah.
So, you know, if he got the nomination, he would, you know, he would probably say, well, I think that, you know, he would
change his mind. Well, just like old Mitt Romney, he was on the Stephanopoulos program this morning for a half hour. It was so painful.
Yeah.
And he changed his mind on he used to be pro-choice.
Pro-gay.
Now he's pro-life. He used to be pro-gay. And now I really don't know. He wanted to vote against the Massachusetts marriage law, right?
Sure. Yeah, yeah. He did that.
But I did see something funny. Jimmy Kimmel said he likes Mitt Romney's campaign slogan, Mitt Happens.
I like that.
I like Jimmy Kimmel.
Here is John in Dearborn. John, you want to talk about that movie?
Yes, Peter, I do know it's a fact because I do own the movie. I recently obtained it, in which they do state the creator of the movie. I can't recall his name offhand, but they have all these extra special things that they put in with the movie. And he said it was to create or to ease world tensions. And Klaatu, the alien, even says, if we can't get along, he's afraid of what's going to happen to the Earth, that it may just become a burned-up cinder.
Yeah,
and
when
they actually try to meet with all the countries, to meet with the alien, there's a lot of conflict and controversy about what country it's going to be in. The usual, you know, bureaucratic take.
Yeah, it is. It is a very cool movie, and it has a very good message of about tolerance and peace and what have you. And do you remember what the spaceman says to the robot? What is it? It's a very famous little...
Gore, Nick. Baraba,
Klaatu,
something like that, to keep him from burning up the woman. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, because that's right, because the robot had that beam on the top of its head. That could be,
right, and it was opening up, and he was going to French fry her.
That's right.
Klaatu, Baraba, Nictu.
Yeah, and all of a sudden it closes again. It was very ominous.
I used to have seen this movie.
Yeah. No, it is.
You know what, Peter? There are actual, like, flaws in the movie. And if you get the same version I have with all of its special trailers and that to go with it, they actually show you. That was the world's tallest man at the time that played the robot.
Is that right?
Yep. And
wow.
He had trouble wearing the suit. It was a latex suit, spray-painted aluminum color to give you this metallic effect.
Well, I've been only watching movies from the 50s, like some of those science fiction flicks, like I was saying, When Worlds Collide and... I'm going to probably go see our rent when the Earth Stood Still. But what else have I seen? On the Waterfront with Marlon Brando, very cool. Viva Zapata with Marlon Brando again, and a bunch of them. Some Alec Guinness movies, some English comedies.
Feeling nostalgic, Peter?
Yeah, from the 50s. No, they just have a real interesting quality to them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, there's something for me to explore.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Actually, we were at the Detroit Film Theater at the Detroit Institute of Arts on Friday and saw this 1939 film called Rules of the Game that is always uniformly considered to be one of the top 10 movies of all times.
Was it remade? Was that one remade?
Yeah. Actually, when Robert Altman did Nashville and what was it called?
He just died, didn't he?
He just died.
Yeah.
But he had, one set in an English manner. And I thought, man, this is something Park with a G, Gosford Park or something.
Gosford.
Gosford Park.
Yeah. I'm hanging in with this conversation well.
And Gosford Park was like identical to the Rules of the Game, essentially.
Okay.
And it was, and all the whole ambience of the film and all these multiple plots and all this ambient noise and stuff going on at the same time. 1939, Jean Renoir, the director.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
Interesting.
All right, well, I'm going to pull your chain about one other thing as well. And that's that Camel Cigarettes has a new brand that's aiming at women.
Oh.
This is nice.
Isn't that sweet?
Yeah. The next time RJ Reynolds. Yeah, tobacco, ask smokers to walk a mile for a Camel. Watch how many of them are in high heels. This is mostly the women. Mostly the women. Reynolds, eager to increase the sale of its fast-growing Camel brand among women, is introducing a variety aimed at female smokers, a new variation, Camel No. 9.
Oh, this is repulsive.
Well, it has a name that evokes women's fragrances, like Chanel No. 19.
Yeah.
Why would they say Chanel No. 19? Well, yeah, as opposed to the big one is Chanel No. 5, right?
Yes.
Yeah. As well as a song about the romance, Love Potion No. 9.
Love Potion, yeah.
Potion, yeah.
I have a confession to make, and I really have. I am not smoking anymore, Peter.
That's good.
I love cigarettes.
Oh.
I just love them. I love to smoke them, but not even this Camel number 9 is going to get me back.
Well, they obviously want to keep you addicted, right?
Yeah, and did you see the package? It's all
pink. It's fuchsia.
Yeah, it's like a real girly color. And,
well, it strikes me that it would be a revolt against the corporations that are trying to addict you and trying to lure you into addiction.
Absolutely, yeah. I remember back in the day when I was just smoking like a chimney, and they'd come out with a new brand, and, you'd be at the bar, and the cigarette girls would come around, you'd be like, sure, I'll try those,
Well, do you know the story, why I stopped smoking?
I don't know the story.
Well, I smoked up till I was about 18 or 19.
Oh.
And remember I showed you a photograph of my wife when she was 18, 19?
Yes.
Yeah, and she would, lick her lips and getting ready to kiss me, and we would just be almost on top of one another, lips just about to meet, and she'd go, oh, you smell, you stink terrible. I'm not kissing you. And she refused to kiss me.
And so you quit. That was love.
Yeah, it was. L-O-V-E, love. I had love-itis.
All right. And you still do.
I still do. We got to get out of here. Stay tuned. We got a couple of interviews. Go to Jalena Mind website. And
Al will be on it, too. Thanks to Al for answering the phones.
Absolutely. Thanks to all of you for listening and calling. Back next week.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Down, down, think aloud. Turn your head now, baby, child. back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. A pleasure to be with you. One of the things that crisis periods bring to us are incredible observers of the contemporary scene. You can just go back all through history. When nothing's happening, you don't have people that you've ever heard about. I mean, think about Mark Twain and, just so many others throughout the decades and even the centuries here of American history. Joining me is one of the observers of the contemporary scene that has been brought forth by what we've experienced over the last 6 years. He's William Rivers Pitt. He's the best-selling author of Our Flag 2, The Paradox of Patriotism, War on Iraq, What Team Bush Doesn't Want You to Know, and The Greatest Sedition is Silence. He's currently the editorial director of Progressive Democrats of America. He writes a blog called We the People, and he continues to write for a website that I think is very important for learning the news, and it's linked on my site, peterwerby.com. That's truthout.org. He's been a lead writer there for 5 years. He worked as a press secretary for Congressman Dennis Kucinich in 2004 for the congressman from Cleveland's presidential bid, and he was a high school English teacher before becoming a full-time writer and political analyst. He lives and works in Boston, Massachusetts. That's where we're reaching him now in the midst of a big storm. William Rivers Pitt, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, this is a hell of a winter, isn't it?
It's so far so good. We're getting a monster storm right now that could have been worse. It's mostly rain at this point.
Rain, wow.
We got cracked.
Here in Michigan, we're in the deep freeze. Your brand new book is called House of Ill Repute, Reflections on War, Lies, and America's Ravaged Reputation. Now, this is a collection of your truthout.org columns?
It is a collection of about 33 essays on a variety of topics going back about 3 years to present day.
Now, this is what's always a challenge about collection of essays is the point at which they're written was so intense, and now we're going to look at it 3 years later or 3 months later. I mean, I can guess your answer at this, but do they hold still? I mean, when you look back at them, are you thinking, ooh, that's a little out of date? Or
now, it's far near the point of the exercise was less to try to sit and yell and scream about the things that I find important as it was to being the stuff that was happening 3 years ago outside the green zone is important today. The stuff that was happening a year and a half ago, 2 years ago with when the Abu Ghraib scandal broke is as important today as it was then. The book is it's not organized chronologically. It's vaguely organized topically, but for people who are well aware of all of the facts and issues that have been going on, and for people who are really just coming to realize what a mess we're in, this book will provide depth and context for both. The most important part of every essay, from my opinion, is the date at the top of each, which marks when it was originally written, because you can read these things now and realize that everything I was talking about 3 years ago, 2 years ago, 1 year ago, is as important and pressing and unresolved today as it was when I originally wrote it.
Well, as you can realize, that was a leading question, and I think even more so. I mean, I did that purposely because I wanted to to get your sense of your essays, but just, and I would I wonder if listeners had the same impression, just because the American historic memory is about a week, a week long.
Absolutely.
So you say Abu Ghraib, you go, oh, yeah.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Donald Rumsfeld, I remember him. it's almost like Monica Lewinsky, when you say Donald Rumsfeld. Hasn't he been gone for just about ever?
If your definition of gone is loose, he's been gone for a really long time.
Well, the essays by William Rivers Pitt in House of Ill Repute do resonate with today's headlines as well. Now, you were, and I didn't know this, you were the press secretary for Congressman Dennis Kucinich.
For a time, yes, I was.
And, a lot of... that seemed like the impossible dream, because someone who has such progressive politics as Congressman Kucinich, you would think, boy, he could never get elected. It's going to be somebody like Hillary. It's going to be somebody like Obama. But I think when you started writing these essays in House of Ill Repute, that maybe the 3 years ago, that maybe the people that agreed with you was around 30% or 40%, and now that's almost doubled. So,
yep.
Yeah.
Well, I think Dennis Kucinich is an interesting allegory for our political situation, because you can characterize that first for the 2004 presidential campaign as being somewhat quixotic. And yet, because, you know, the man who everyone wrote off as quote-unquote unelectable, the guy whose progressive ideas were too extreme for the mainstream, who got pretty much written off by the mainstream press and therefore by the public, even, like, before the wheels on his campaign really started to get going, is now today the only man, the only human being running for president who was 100% correct on the war, who voted correctly for the war, and who brought more than 100 members of the House of Representatives with him on that vote for the war back in October of 2003. It's going to add a very interesting dynamic to the debates that come up, but I also think it's an interesting little picture of the problems that we as consumers of information encounter when the mainstream media gets to decide who is and is not acceptable.
Well, William Rivers Pitt, you worked with Dennis Kucinich, and his ideas were terrific. They were challenging, and I suspect that the reason that he did not fare well is all in dollars. Can anyone that's not being bought and sold, that with now it looks like we're talking about spending this next election cycle, they're talking about spending $500 million?
Well, there will be the fact that these guys, and this is one of the worst things that's ever happened to me, the fact that these guys have started so early means that there is almost certainly going to be a billion-dollar candidate before the deal goes down. And for a guy like Dennis, yeah, it is a huge, it's a huge obstacle to overcome the financial constraints of someone who isn't taking money from ExxonMobil and AT&T and a lot of the people who, a lot of the organizations and companies who are tied in with the very problems that guys like Dennis Kucinich are trying to solve. I remember very clearly sitting out, camping out in a hotel room in Detroit right before the Michigan primary, writing press releases, but also trying to craft fundraising letters to the base, the people who were carrying the campaign along, getting $5, $10, $20 from everybody. When you can't cut a $1 million check, I'm sitting here in Detroit trying to figure out a way out of this problem, it becomes a challenge. And it is one of the core problems with politics in the country right now.
Tell me a little about the woman who wrote the introduction, the foreword to your book, House of Ill Repute, Cindy Sheehan. She's just so revered and loved by people in the progressive and anti-war movement, yet I mean, she is literally the Jane Fonda of our era in the manner of which the right reviles her.
Well, that's because, I mean, if you cannot defeat somebody in a contest of ideas or a contest of debate, the best thing that you can do is try to take them down with vituperation, insults, and just general grossness of character. Cindy Sheehan is, for my money, the person who put the issue of the war into everybody's backyards in a way that it had not been there before. I mean, right now, most of the country, as you say, looks at this war and looks at this occupation and sees it for the disaster that it is. But in August of 2005, when she camped herself out down there in Texas, that general consensus had not been reached. And I think a lot of the reason was because for a lot of people, the occupation of Iraq and everything that was happening over there was a TV show. You know, the thing you see for 7 minutes on the news at night and then is out of your mind. We are far away from the Vietnam era where the draft put that war into everybody's neighborhood and everybody's kitchen and everybody's backyard. Cindy Sheehan, by taking that stand down there in Texas, gave all of the problems and all of the horrific parts of this war and this situation a face and a core of emotional depth that had previously not been there. And that's probably another reason why the folks on the far right don't like her very much, because trying to argue with a grieving mother about something that's so glaringly obvious, I can imagine that's pretty difficult. So she is one of the, for my money, she is one of the most important people. When we look back on this whole situation several years from now, and we mark the moment when opinion on this situation turned against the administration and against the people who got us in there, the face and words and deeds of Cindy Sheehan are going to be the beginning of when all of that began to change.
I have great respect for her. I saw her at a workshop in Caracas, Venezuela, in last year for the World Social Forum. And after my friend and I were walking down the streets in Caracas, and suddenly I saw her and I said, "Cindy," and she looked at me because so many people know her and probably call her by her first name. And I said, "I'm a friend of Medea Benjamin's, Medea Benjamin, who with Code Pink." And I said, "Can I have my picture taken with you? I've never done anything like that in my life."
Yeah.
So I've got that photograph on my website. House of Ill Repute is the book, subtitled Reflections on War, Lies, and America's Ravaged Reputation. William Rivers Pitt is my guest. The book is published by Polly Point Press. You can go to p3books.com. Truthout.org is where most of these essays first appeared. That's quite an analogy, House of Ill Repute. That's a whorehouse. Let's say it flat out. I mean, is it that bad?
It's pretty bad. It's difficult to encompass how much worse it can get. And this is a very long conversation the constrictions of radio time, I can't really get nuts about it. But in essence, one of the things we talk about in politics these days is the debate over a withdrawal plan for Iraq. On the Democratic side, it's pretty much become axiomatic that a withdrawal is necessary, but it's the how and when and, the means of getting it done that have become the center of debate. Guys like Biden say, "Well, we can't leave immediately because it'll be a catastrophe." The Democratic Progressive Caucus in the House, on the other hand, is drafting legislation to get us out yesterday. On the Republican side, they're split down the middle, less because of the moral questions involved, and this is just the way politics is, and more because they're staring down the barrel of an election next year that they don't want this thing around their necks like a millstone. None of this debate is taking place in the White House because they went into Iraq in the first place with the full intention of remaining there permanently. The establishment of permanent military bases in Iraq was one of the main purposes of this invasion. They have no interest in leaving. So you get around to the question of the House of Ill Repute, the whorehouse. These guys want to stay there permanently. They are getting crushed in the polls. They got wiped out in the last election. Their political capital, it would seem to be bleeding to death all around them, and yet they're not even blinking. They're not moving. They're not even considering changing course, which leads you to question, who is their actual constituency? Who is it that they care about? Who are they actually working for? Because it's not you, it's not me, it's not the majority of the American people, and as sure as bleep, not the American soldiers and the families who are dealing with this war on a very personal level. And I'm led to believe that it's because a very small segment of the economy, the defense contractors, the military contractors, the oil and petroleum industry, as well as companies like Halliburton, KBR, Bechtel, are making, I mean, that we've spent $600 billion on this war so far. Economist whose name I can't recall once described a crash on the stock market. He described your money during a crash as disappearing the way your lap disappears when you stand up. It's a nice analogy, but that $600 billion went somewhere. It is currently in the bank accounts of half a dozen to a dozen companies. That's the whorehouse. That's
and
the House of Ill Repute.
Well, William Rivers Pitt, who is the John? Who's paying?
All of us.
There you go.
You know, the...
Well, wait. What else could we have done with $600 billion?
Well, the hell. If you take it back a few steps, I mean, even before the war got started, this was going on. There was a $2 to $3 trillion budget surplus in the bank thanks to the Clinton economy. The very first thing these guys did was give it all away in tax cuts, and 42% of that money went to the 1% of the country. You know, there's a very good argument that says that this entire administration, both before the war and after it, was a smash-and-grab robbery to get to that money in the Treasury.
Well, superficially, it appears as though, quote, we, quote, have won. In terms of the ideas, if you want to see the political expression of those ideas in the Democratic Party triumph, yet, as you're indicating, we're still at square one.
In a lot of ways, we absolutely are. This isn't going to change a lot of stuff. And it's less that our ideas and our arguments did not win out in this. I mean, the progressive left, the people who have been arguing against this war since the beginning, can, I think, rightfully say that all of the hard work that we did to try to get this message out has slowly but surely worked its way into the consciousness of the general population. But the downside of this and the great fear and the, just one of our big problems isn't so much that the Democratic Party came up with this great slate of policy ideas and arguments and stood forth about all this great stuff that convinced the American people to side with them. It's that we were the only alternative to this unbelievable catastrophe. It wasn't so much that we've won, it's that they lost.
Mm-hmm.
And that bodes ill for the future. We've got the Democrats have the majority in Congress, and I'm very happy about that because one-party rule, having, you know, a greased skid between crazy House committee members through the Senate and up to the White House desk where they sign the bills, things were passing too quickly. There was no debate, there was no argument, and there was a lot of bad stuff going through. Now that government is divided, it's naturally slowing things down. And slowing things down was the first and foremost necessity in the situation that we were in. But I am not at all terrified. I mean, they couldn't even pull off a debate about a non-binding resolution on Iraq in the Senate without getting tangled up in themselves. So, I mean, I believe the House is going to be where a lot of the leadership comes on this issue, because the Senate is 100 people who all think they should be president.
Well, people on the left, Democrats and others of a more progressive nature than the centrist factions that have dominated since, I don't know when, maybe since ever, have always hoped that they could make the Democratic Party into a real alternative rather than just being the other half of the ruling racket that was a little bit better. I mean, for instance, at the 2004 Republican convention in New York City, when tens of thousands of people came out to protest against the renomination of George W. Bush, someone told me, I wasn't there, they said there were about 20,000 anti-Bush signs and about 10 Kerry signs.
Yep.
So it's a you can't win on a negative. It's about, what was it, Poppy, that said you got the vision thing?
Yeah.
I mean, there's not a vision thing, is there? And there needs to be that if we're talking about renewal of this country.
Well, one of the big problems that the Democratic Party has is that it does not have a leader. The vision thing comes when you've got 435 people in the House, another 51 in the Senate, and they're all trying to come up with these ideas, and it's governing by committee. There's a reason why the executive branch was created. In government, there kind of needs to be a point person. Any political party kind of needs the same thing. Otherwise, it's factions with varying, slightly differentiated ideas banging each other's heads together, trying to come up with a coherent, concept for, how the government and how the country should be run. Without a leader, without someone at the top, it's difficult to get a coherent, singular message out. I know for a fact, and I believe very strongly, that there are a lot of very good ideas and a lot of very good policy initiatives and a lot of good legislation that is either being written or is already on the way through the pipeline in this new Democratic Congress. Some of it bangs into each other. Some of it seems antithetical to the bill sitting right next to it. But the party itself, it isn't bereft of ideas. It's not that they are without the moral and ethical and tactical ability to come up with a plan to help the country. It's that it's a bunch of people in a room shouting at each other. And until there's a leader of the party, some of the presidential candidate or a president, God willing, you're not going to see the kind of organized ideas that we had when Clinton was president or when Reagan was president. Those guys were leaders of that party, and it's much easier to telegraph your policy ideas to the American people if it's one person saying it.
My guest on the Peter Werbe Show, William Rivers Pitt, his latest book is a collection of his essays from truthout.org. It's called House of Ill Repute, Reflections on War, Lies, and America's Ravaged Reputation. It's published by Polly Point Press. In the time remaining, which isn't a great amount, let's talk about the 2008 elections and also, is there going to be a war in Iran? Starting with the 2008 election, some of the prevailing thought is that any Democrat can win in 2008. given that things remain as they are. I just can't believe that a black man with a middle name of Hussein is actually going to be able to be even nominated, let alone win the presidency. So, I mean, is this Hillary versus whoever?
Who knows? I think that there may be some pretty interesting surprises in store for these primaries. It's a dirty little secret in American politics that not everybody running for president is running for president. I have in the back of my head that Barack Obama is running for vice president.
Huh.
Whatever flaws that he has in the idea that, you know, putting him into the executive spot, the lack of experience, what have you, I think he would make a dynamite second seat on any ticket that you put him into. Money's going to be a lot of it, I think, which puts Hillary at the front of the line to a degree. But Howard Dean showed us the last time around that having all the money doesn't necessarily translate into victory. It's going to be a fascinating race on both sides. You have to remember in primary elections are a little bit like midterms. It's the base that votes.
Sure.
So Hillary's going to have a challenge in New Hampshire. She's going to have a challenge in a lot of the northeastern states. I think guys like Edwards are going to make a little bit more noise than you might expect.
Well, which is why the Republican candidates now are all barking like junkyard dogs to try to get the right wing even Giuliani. I mean, what, pro-gay, pro-abortion? Me?
Yeah.
No, never.
Yeah. Well, I think it's my favorite part of this is going to be less about the Democratic slate that's coming down the pike, but watching all of these, you know, but by our modern definition, left-wing Republicans try to wend their way through some of the southern and western primaries. These guys don't forget. The base doesn't forget that Giuliani's a big city, fetus-killing, gun-grabbing liberal by their lights. I think a lot of these Republican candidates are going to have trouble with guys like Brownback and Gingrich, who are beloved by the base. They're going to do well in these primaries. It's going to be an interesting run.
Well, William Rivers Pitt, just in the time remaining, let's talk a little about Iran. I have a bet with a friend of mine that the United States will not attack Iran. And we've got like a $50 bet that goes, one of us is going to write a check to Food Not Bombs. What do you think?
Up until several weeks ago, I was right in that camp. I was, you see all the sort of, oh, my goodness, they're getting ready to go arguments posted on Internet boards, and I would have to come up and say, geez, you know, it's insane. The idea of attacking Iran, their sunburst missile batteries along the mountains of the Persian Gulf would turn, you know, it would be like ducks on the pond with our carrier battle groups out there. The Quds Force is Mossad-level effective at, you know, delivering counterstrikes. Our soldiers in Iraq would be unbelievably exposed should we do this. And, oh, by the way, Iran has recently made massive economic deals and for oil with China. So if we screw with Iran, we're screwing with China's economy. There are a raft of reasons why it would be beyond psychotic to go into some kind of a shooting war with Iran for a bunch of other reasons. Our military is not really up to the drill right now. I thought this until a few weeks ago, and I was very comfortable with it. And over the last couple of weeks, I've been made more and more nervous because these guys have started to growl at Iran and make these accusations. And it's not perhaps that they intend to, but their track record for competence in dealing with situations like this means that one of these guys could trip over their shoelaces, and the next thing you know, we're in a shooting war.
Well, it seems pretty clear when you have General Peter Pace, the Marine Commandant, essentially contradicting that the idea that this weaponry has come directly from the highest level of the
Iranian. In public. Deferring and disagreeing with this,
which says to me that he's saying that the military does not want to do that. That they think the president is stupid and that the vice president, who's probably running things, is insane.
So this was one of the things that I thought would happen if they were growling at Iran. I would be the Joint Chiefs that would put a stop to it.
Sure.
So it was interesting to see that, you know, George gets on TV today and starts quacking about, yeah, they're sending bombs over and we're going to do something about it, while every other newspaper has a very quiet, well, they're backing off of this now. The fact that the Joint Chief stepped forward and disagreed with his commander in public is I would be interested to go through the, you know, the old newspapers to try to figure out when the last time something like that happened.
Hmm. Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Listeners, if you like what you've heard, and I assume you do, because I thought our guest is terrific, there's a collection of his essays from truthout.org, a site I highly recommend. It's on my website, peterwerby.com. William Rivers Pitt's brand new book is called House of Ill Repute, Reflections on War, Lies, and America's Ravaged Reputation. It's available from Polypoint Press, p3books.com. Some other authors I've interviewed are on that label as well. Or what? Not label. What are that? I'm thinking like a DJ.
I have no idea.
All right. William Rivers Pitt, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is WRIM.com.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. It's a pleasure to be with you. You know, there's a lot of intractable ethnic conflict or conflicts around the world are seemingly ethnic, and if you're outside of it, it doesn't have the details imprinted as in your mind as it does if you're directly involved. And think about so many of them around the world, the Serbs and the Kosovars, the Catholics and the Protestants in Northern Ireland, what's happening in Sri Lanka, and of course one that we hear about so frequently that is in the news so often is the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians. And there's also a lot of solutions floated, if you think about it. There are Israelis that would like to essentially ethnically cleanse the West Bank and Gaza and make it all a greater Israel. There are some Palestinians that would like to remove what they call the Zionist entity completely. But probably when we move beyond that, we hear most frequently the two-state solution. Two people sharing the same land but separated, much like the 1948 United Nations resolution intended. So there'd be two separate countries, and these warring people, cousins as though they may be, would not be linked together in any way. And so all of the activity seems to be around how can we bring that about? How can we bring it back fairly? What percentage of the West Bank would the Palestinians get? You've probably heard a lot of that. Joining me is Ali Abu Nima, and he has a very, very unique suggestion for a solution. The book is called One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Impasse. And Ali Abu Nima is a Palestinian-American. He lives in Chicago. He's the co-creator and editor of Electronic Intifada and also Electronic Iraq. He's a graduate of Princeton University. He's a frequent speaker and commentator on Middle East affairs, and he's written for major papers like the Chicago Tribune and the Los Angeles Times. He directs research for the Design of Children's Services in the United States and Europe. Ali Abu Nima, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you. It's my pleasure, Peter.
I have heard you before. You are a man greatly desiring peace from people of your ethnic background, the Palestinians, and in the region in general. But I think when people hear the phrase intifada, and your website is called Electronic Intifada, they think immediately violent suicide bombing, all of that. I mean, these are the images that arise immediately. Tell us about your website and about that image and how you feel about it.
Well, that's exactly why we chose the name, in order to dispel that image, because intifada doesn't actually mean that. What intifada means is shaking off. And in the case of Palestinians, it's a word that has been around for many, many decades and indicates a shaking off of injustice, a shaking off of oppression. It has come to be associated in many minds with violence, although that is not the intent at all. And so we use the word in order to talk about using language, using the web, using images, using speech in order to bring light and to bring some knowledge to people about this situation.
I think a lot of people would say, well, I see information about this conflict, about the people of both countries, people of both ethnic origins. I see it all the time on television. Why do we need an electronic intifada to tell us more stories?
Well, because I think most people understand that, unfortunately, nowadays, with the exception, of course, of good programming like yours, the media are failing to give us an in-depth understanding of any issue. It becomes so much like either just a horse race or a boxing match. We see it in politics where it's all about the personalities and not about the policies. We see it on complex international issues where everything gets reduced to black and white. And so this is an effort to bring nuance, perspective, humor. Most people don't know much about the Palestinians. They don't know about their art, about their culture, about their comedy, about all aspects of Palestinian life. And indeed, there are many Israeli voices that we bring through the Electronic Intifada, dissenting Israeli voices that are generally not heard in our media. And those are very important voices, too.
Ali Abu Nima, I would think once you move outside of the Jewish community and outside of the Arab American community, as you said, it looks to many people like a boxing match. I think they're among Euro-Americans particularly. There's a greater affinity with the Israelis because many of them are of European extraction themselves. They look like us. They talk English frequently. But oftentimes people think they act mean. They you know, we see these images of what they're doing in West Bank and Gaza. And then the Palestinians seem a little crazy, right? They're always fighting. They're fighting among themselves. They do suicide bombings. So you have these stereotypes that don't go, as you said, very deep into an analysis of what's really going on. What's missing? What's needed?
Well, what's missing is the whole picture. And if you talk about violence, the media do tend to portray Palestinians as if they're the violent ones. But let's just take the numbers from last year from the Israeli human rights organization B'Tselem, a very well-known, famous Israeli human rights organization. Last year, Palestinians killed 26 Israelis, according to B'Tselem. And Israelis, on the other hand, the Israeli army and settlers killed over 600 Palestinians. So you do the math yourself. That's about 30 Palestinians killed for every Israeli that was killed in this conflict last year. So that's just one very stark, concrete example. But if you look at the debate that has been generated by President Carter's book, where he has used the word apartheid to describe what is happening to the Palestinians in the occupied territories, it does suggest that there is something going on here. If a very measured man, a former president of the United States, indeed someone who has been a lifelong supporter of Israel, will use such a word, then surely we need to be asking questions about what is really happening to the Palestinians, what Israel is doing with the billions and billions of dollars in U.S. Tax money that we give it every year. Just recently, the U.S. Very rarely openly criticized Israel for misusing weapons that the U.S. gave to Israel in Lebanon, using cluster bombs against civilian areas. So there are questions to be asked about why we're in this situation and why it's lasted so long.
Well, let's talk a little about language. You use the phrase you often hear when describing President Carter. You call him a supporter of Israel. It's not a phrase that you often hear about another country. No one says, are you a supporter of England, or are you a supporter of Chile, or, you know, are you a supporter of Pakistan or Vietnam? How is that injected in that form into American politics? And if you would, why does President Carter find himself in some quarters in such trouble for even raising this question of the activities of the Israeli government?
That's a very good question. I think one all Americans need to ask. I think there is a basic understanding among people in this country that somehow the conflict in Palestine, Israel, is central to the U.S. We are not bystanders on the side. We are heavily backing one side. Israel gets billions of dollars from us. They get massive diplomatic support. In fact, survey after survey from major universities, institutions, all over the world have found time and again that, you know, like the Pew Charitable Trusts that do these surveys around the world every year, that it is U.S. support for Israel that is so responsible for the bad image that the U.S. has around the world, because the rest of the world perceives Israel as being largely in the wrong, as having taken Palestinian land, forced the Palestinians into this apartheid-like situation, and then refusing to come to peaceful terms with them. In this country, the view is very much the opposite. It's that Israel is the victim, the Palestinians are the ones that refuse to recognize Israel, and Israel is in the right. And so we have this odd situation where we are the most powerful country in the world, but the debate about Israel-Palestine takes place kind of in a vacuum, kind of in a bubble, and where our politicians are really quite intimidated from being forthright about Israel. I'll give you a very concrete example of that. My former state senator, a little-known fellow called Barack Obama, as he was then. And he was my state senator in an area that has a large Palestinian community. He used to be, or at least we perceived him as being very, very forthright and open and even-handed and wanting to be very fair to Palestinians and Israelis. Once he got to national prominence, he kind of clammed up. Now, to the extent that he's spoken in public, he's taken a much more pro-Israeli line, or he doesn't say anything. And that's something that has been very, very sad and disappointing for those of us who are very early supporters of Barack Obama. Why does this happen to all of our politicians, and why do they only speak out once they retire, like President Carter? You have a very interesting paper from Harvard professor Stephen Walt. He was actually my thesis advisor at the University of Chicago, and John Mearsheimer, another professor at the University of Chicago, who wrote this paper last year called The Israel Lobby, which delves into these issues and tries to get to the bottom of why Israel and the pro-Israel lobby have this hold on our politicians. And it's a very controversial subject, but it's one that we absolutely have to take by the horns, because bad policy making, the refusal to be critical on foreign policy, the refusal to ask the tough questions, and the willingness to go along is what got us into Iraq, because nobody said, wait a minute, why are we doing this? What's the truth? And you look at the pattern again now with Iran, where every day there are new allegations about Iran, and everyone is jumping on the bandwagon. Will we find ourselves in another war with Iran because nobody dared to ask the right questions?
My guest on the Peter Werbe Show, Ali Abu Nima, he's written One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Impasse, and I promise you, dear listeners, that we will get to the proposal. It's published by Metropolitan Books, and you can go to Ali Abu Nima's website, Electronic Intifada, intifada.net. I spelled that right, right?
Yes, you did.
Good. Good for me. It's also linked on my site, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com. There's, of course, swirling around President Carter's book and also the two professors' analysis of the strength of the Israeli lobby, the charge of anti-Semitism, that if you say that Jews in America who are supporters of Israel have a disproportionate have disproportionate pressure within the government, or they can get congresspeople and senators to vote their way. If you say that, if you make that utterance, then you're looked upon with suspicion. But if you just remove that, I mean, I usually tell people when Arab Americans have more voters and can contribute more money, is the Israeli lobby will quickly drop into second place. It is a matter of votes and money. Simple as that.
Well, I agree with that. I think there are other factors. There are sort of cultural and historical factors. There's a lot of guilt about how anti-Semitic and anti-Jewish the elites were in this country for many, many years, in the 30s and 40s and 50s. You talked about, you said I was a graduate of Princeton. Well, my own alma mater was very anti-Jewish and anti-Semitic, and either excluded Jews completely or limited them to a very strict quota. And all of our elite institutions in this country have to account for that. So we have a long history of anti-Semitism and anti-Jewish hatred in our country. And so part of the support for Israel, I think, is motivated by guilt and wanting to atone for the wrongs that we have done to American Jewish citizens. But when that tips over into condoning wrong and condoning the wrong policies of the State of Israel, then we're no longer doing justice. So I think there are complicated factors.
Sure. At a minimum.
Of course, not all Jews agree with the State of Israel. That's the other big myth that the small, powerful pro-Israel groups want to put about, which is that all Jews agree with them. It's not true.
No, absolutely it is not. And in fact, because I have on my website, peterwerbe.com, a section on Israel and Palestine, I've been called anti-Semitic. And I say, with the exception of your website, Ali Abu Nima, every other link on there is either Jewish American or Israeli. That's where, I mean, how do I know what's going on there? I have to get information from somewhere. And as you mentioned at near the beginning of the show, that we're talking about the dissent within Israel to Israeli policies in the exact manner that so many of us objected now to the point where we're a majority to the Iraq war. You can certainly take into, you can be critical of your government or other governments without bringing in some, you know, sort of...
Well, I mean, to say that being critical of Israel is anti-Semitic would be like saying that, opposing slavery or opposing Jim Crow or opposing segregation was anti-American. And, of course, there were people who said it was anti-American. And aren't we glad that they lost the debate?
Yes, let's do this, though, because that's why you've written a book, because we could talk for probably 3 or 4 hours. But let's focus in on a rather unique proposal to end the conflict with Israel and Palestine. The big solution always put forth by the seemingly rational people and the big powers is that there is an equitable split of the land. It begins with the land that Israel already has, but then the debate is how much do the Palestinians get of the West Bank and Gaza. Your book is called One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Impasse. Ali Abu Nima, if you could summarize that. You take a whole book to do it, so it's a challenge to do it, I think, in a few sentences.
Well, I will try. The title of the book is both a recognition and a look towards the future. It's a recognition of the reality that Israel-Palestine is and has always been one multi-ethnic, multi-religious country. And in fact, the conflict started because of the attempt to partition, to divide the country into separate states. The first proposal for partition in 1937 by the British who ruled it then was to create a Jewish state, but they recognized that you could only do that by expelling most of the Palestinians from their homes. And in fact, when Israel was created 10 years later, that's what happened. Most of the Palestinians, including my mother, and I write about her experience in the book, were expelled from their homes, and that's what gave rise to the conflict. Since then, Israel has never lived in peace, because Palestinians want to return to their homes. At the same time, Israelis say, well, we want our own country. It turns out, and I go into this in detail in the book, so I won't try to spell it out here, that actually you can get most people to agree in principle to the idea of dividing the country. But in practice, it turns out to be impossible. So I look at other situations that are very similar in terms of the history, the kind of narratives that the different peoples have, like in South Africa, where you had the whites who came from Europe and who saw South Africa as their promised land, and you had the native Africans, and you have, you mentioned in your introduction, Ireland, where you have Catholics and Protestants. Again, a very similar situation, not just to do with religion or skin color or language, but to do with power, to do with one group seeing themselves as the native people against a colonizer, and the colonizer seeing themselves as the righteous, or the rightful owners of the land. And these sorts of conflicts go on for generations and generations to the point where everybody is completely trapped by them. So I look at how people in South Africa in particular, but also in Northern Ireland, in Belgium, another country I lived in where there's a long ethnic conflict, have gotten out of these situations. And the solution I put forward is a single state, which is a democratic state, which recognizes that there are different communities living in it and gives them equal rights and protections. Now, that also sounds very simple on paper. It's much more complicated in reality, and that's why I wrote the book. But the book is designed to be a very straightforward description of what's gone wrong with the current approach, the two-state approach, why it can't work, and why this alternative is better. And it's the alternative that originally, many Jews and Palestinians supported way back at the beginning, and we're starting to see a lot more support for it coming now among Palestinians, but even among some Israelis as well, and its time has come.
Well, I'm reminded, as oftentimes people don't realize, like in all countries, there's a left and a right, even though they talk about the Labor Party and the right wing of in politics. But one of the most far right-wing politicians, in fact, to the point of easily being identified as a fascist, Meir Kahane, who was an American Jew, emigrated to Israel and was eventually assassinated. He said famously one time, I say famously, I'll have to check and see whether you've heard this. He said, Israel can either be Jewish or democratic. He meant that, he was for expelling the Arab, the Arab citizens of Israel, the citizens of Israel, because he was fearful that the demographics of the Arab Israelis would soon overwhelm the Jewish population and it would cease to have that unique Jewish character. Well, certainly among many, many American Jews and among many Israelis, that they feel safe having the character of Israel be maintained as a Jewish nation. Your proposal would not only eliminate that, but it could bring about, they would feel, their worst fears.
Not at all. I think that on the contrary, right now Israel is headed at full speed into a dead end. And if Israel doesn't dramatically change its approach, I doubt it will be there as we know it in 20 or 30 years' time. Why? Because the reality is, and you've pointed this out, that in all the land controlled by Israel, Israel, the West Bank and Gaza Strip, Jews are now barely 50% of the population. Because the Palestinian population has grown so fast, Jewish immigration to Israel has collapsed. Most of the world's Jews do not live in Israel, and most of them do not want to move to Israel. So Israel is in a situation where you have a quote-unquote Jewish state ruling over a 50% population that is not Jewish. And in 10, 15, 20 years, Jews will only be 40% of the population. And so that's where you really get into the situation where Israel looks like an apartheid state. You have a Jewish minority ruling over a disenfranchised majority that has no democratic rights. And in the long term, this will not succeed. You look inside Israel, you have 5 million Jews living with 1 million Palestinians. Those 1 million Palestinians are the descendants of the few Palestinians who remained behind, who were not forced out when Israel was created. They just came out with a document supported by all their leaders across the community of Palestinians in Israel saying, Israel cannot be a state where one ethnic group has rights. It has to be a democracy. And they explicitly said, let's turn it into a democracy like Belgium, where you have different communities that are recognized. I was very pleased when I saw that, because that's exactly the idea I had in my book. And why are different people independently coming to this conclusion? Because it makes sense. Because when you have a multi-ethnic, multi-religious country, you cannot have rule by one group for one group. And so those who are in the comfort of the United States, American Jews, who want to have the emotional comfort of Israel as a Jewish state, well, that's fine for them over here, but it's Israelis and Palestinians who have to live with the consequences. So I sincerely believe that if Palestine Israel is to maintain a vibrant Jewish community speaking Hebrew, living its life according to its religious customs, its cultural customs, then it can only really be in the framework of recognizing that other people have the right to do the same. And no country where one group has said, it's for me and me alone, has ever lived in peace. We did not have peace in this country when in the South, whites said, it's for us and us alone. There was no peace in South Africa when whites said, it's for us and us alone. There was no peace in Ireland when the ruling Protestants, backed by the British, said, Ireland is for us and us alone. It cannot be in the 21st century. We have to have a different way. And that's what I try to start a discussion about in the book. And I'm very open about the fact that I don't have all the answers, but it is an invitation to people to look for hope and to look for solutions that are really inclusive. And that's what we need. When we look at the Middle East now, I believe it's not beyond hope. But if we do not seize the opportunities we have now, then who knows if we will be able to save the situation.
Well, I think so much of it is described in your subtitle, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Impasse. My guest has been Ali Abu Nima. The book is One Country. It's published by Metropolitan Books. And Ali Abu Nima's incredible website for information about the Middle East is available at Electronic Intifada, intifada.net, and also Electronic Iraq. .net as well. And you can go to my website as well, Peter Werbe, werbe.com, and link there as well. Thank you so much for being on the Peter Werbe Show.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
RIF Detroit Slayer stepping in following Peter Werby and Julian Jordan with Night Call. Happy Monday to you as I'm here taking care of you on the late night before Drew and Mike kick off with the best of at 6 a.m. Riff Rock coming up this hour. We got the latest from Killswitch, the Chili's, and the Mighty Met. But right now, kicking it off with Linkin Park with Crawling. 101 WRIF Detroit, everything that rocks.